from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in all the world's time zones. Every single one of them covered like a blanket by this very unusual program called Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. It is my distinct pleasure and honor to be guiding you through the weekend. Right off the bat, before I even get to any world news, I want to get this on the air just in case. This is one of those just-in-case things. Kathy, wherever Kathy is out there, I don't think it's Woodbridge Kathy, but you never know, says, hey, Art, at Princeton, the eggs are going bonkers tonight. If you get a chance, check them out. So I did go up there to the Princeton site and did kind of check it out, and I don't have a good reference. However, there is a one page on the Princeton site where you can actually monitor the individual eggs and their activity, and it did seem to be really cooking along. And some of the numbers for this date seemed like they were through the roof. So maybe I've got that all wrong. Some of the rest of you can take a look and let me know what you think about the Princeton eggs tonight. But just in case, the little hairs on the back of my neck are standing up. And this, you know, this would seem to confirm that. So if something is about to happen, then maybe you heard it here first. I don't know. Maybe nothing, huh? I'm just telling you that they did seem extremely active. Now, what's going on in the world otherwise? Well, not much good. The man who fatally shot 7 people during a quiet church service. You know, just the fact that in this day and age, we're getting to the point where I think we're getting used to hearing things like this. The guy who shot 7 people at a quiet church service before finally turning the gun on himself was apparently on the verge of losing his job. As well, he was upset over a sermon he heard a couple of weeks ago. It's just that I think we're getting used to hearing these kind of headlines and sorts of headlines, and we're getting hardened, a little cynical. The hostage who helped end the 26-hour manhunt for the man accused of killing a judge and 3 others apparently had long talks with her captor during the 13 hours she was held in her own apartment. Police say she conducted herself very well. I wonder if she actually talked the hostage taker out of what he was doing. If so, really good job. Israel's cabinet on Sunday affirms it is going to dismantle 24 illegal West Bank settlement outposts, but did not say whether they'd be removed and evaded any sort of decision at all on the rest of the 81 that are out there. The Walt Disney Corporation, this is interesting, said Sunday, its president, Robert Iger, will succeed Michael Eisner as chief executive, and that Eisner will leave his post a year earlier than previously announced. And this one should certainly vibrate a little bit for you. China's national legislature on Monday overwhelmingly approved a law. This is a law authorizing a military attack to stop Taiwan from pursuing formal independence. That's a day after the president in Taiwan told the 2.5 million member People's Liberation Army, that would be of China rather, to be prepared for war. The measure was approved by a vote of, a lot of dissent here, 2,896-0. With 2 abstentions. 2 abstentions, huh? On the last day of the Figurehead National People's Congress annual session. I love that vote. That's when you can tell you're in the presence of real freedom. 2,896 to go to war, 0 opposing, 2 abstentions, and they're now hanging from flagpoles. Well, I don't know about the last of that, but probably. There is a very good reason tonight, folks, to have Jim Berkland on the program. The amount of news right now about seismic activity in volcanoes is absolutely overwhelming. Mount St. Helens may not be the only Northwest volcano spitting lava these days. A scientific SWAT team from Seattle is sailing this afternoon. This was an article on, I think, the 5th. For a spot off the Vancouver Island area where they suspect an underwater eruption is underway now. We really don't know what to expect, said Edward Baker, an oceanographer at the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. If we're lucky, we might get pictures of brand new lava on the seafloor. Now that would be, I guess, scientific luck. But I don't know if it'd be luck for the people of the Northwest. Their observations will, of course, help improve understanding of the Juan de Fuca plate, a tectonic time bomb capable of producing earthquakes and tsunamis on par with the disaster that struck the Indian Ocean in December. Baker said it's been going on long enough now that we're pretty sure lava is moving. We're about to go to open lines. I've got a little more just ahead, but open lines for the rest of this hour. And then, of course, Jim Berkland. All right, a few more items. Again, really in the same category. This is a really good night for Jim Berkland. As you know, there was a fireball that moved very slowly over the Northwest just before 8 o'clock last night. And there was also a concurrent earthquake. It was perhaps just before, maybe 10 minutes before, about 3.3. Parts of downtown Seattle also experienced a brief power outage all at about the same time. And from Whitley Strieber's Unknown Country, there's also a lot of news about all of this. An earthquake swarm, of course, off the coast of Oregon that I already mentioned. And just all kinds of activity going on all over the world. Here's a story about a supervolcano. There are enough supervolcanoes on Earth to wipe out much of the planet, and they may wake up much sooner than we thought, says the story. Supervolcanoes explode with a force that is thousands of times that of a normal volcanic eruption. Earthquake experts once thought that it would perhaps take hundreds of thousands of years for the reservoirs of molten rock called magma lying beneath the supervolcano, any supervolcano, to build up enough pressure to cause an eruption. But a few studies show that the time between eruptions can actually be only tens of thousands of years, meaning that a lot of them may be long overdue. And here's a story about a double volcanic eruption in eastern Russia, acquired from orbit 800 kilometers away. The Envisat image shows two volcanoes erupting simultaneously on Russia's snowy Kamchatka Peninsula this week. Located in the Russian Far East, the peninsula is a landscape covered with volcanoes, part of the Pacific Ring of Fire. And these two volcanoes apparently are going off at exactly the same time. So all kinds of earthquake-type news going on. Oh, there's way I definitely want to get this in. This is insane, in my opinion. The fur is going to fly when cat lovers hear about Mark Smith's idea. Perhaps you've already heard about it. This Wisconsin hunter and firefighter wants stray cats classified as an unprotected species that could be shot by anybody with a small game license. Smith welcomes wild birds onto his property, but if he sees a cat, he thinks invasive animals should be considered fair game. 48-year-old firefighter from La Crosse, Wisconsin, has proposed that hunters in Wisconsin make free-roaming domestic cats an unprotected species that could be shot by anybody at will with a small game license. What a bad idea. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? I mean, a pet would get loose, perhaps, and wander into his area, and away they go. I would think making it open season on either dogs or cats. First of all, how would you know if they're wild or not? You wouldn't. And even if they are, certainly I would think you would not want to shoot them. A first-time caller line, you are on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Phil calling from Virginia, one of your truck driving friends here.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Coming off the scale. Last night when you had Willie on talking about biodiesel, can you go on a little bit more detail of that? You said you have a diesel pusher motorhome, right?
I do, yes.
And you can run it on straight vegetable oil.
Right. Well, apparently so. Or something grown by a farmer, or, yeah, all kinds of things. So I'd like to give it a try, actually. We're going to find a place, and we're going to give it a shot.
Well, it's a little bit different than biodiesel. This is just stuff that, like, you dump right in there off the shelf.
I've heard that. Somebody actually called me last night and said he ran out of fuel and went in, got some oil, dumped it into the tank, and it worked.
I have a old Mercedes diesel that I run on vegetable oil all the time.
Really? Yeah, well, that's also what Willie does, not on vegetable oil, but on biodiesel. The whole concept is fascinating, and if it really can be done, then come on, let's think about it a little bit. It would help the American farmer, right, tremendously. It would help all of us because we need not chase after all this very expensive, both in terms of money and lives, foreign oil. And we can begin doing it right now. I mean, right now. If you're a trucker, there's not a thing in the world. If there's any drawback to some of these diesel mixtures, it's that in cold weather, or if you let it sit for a very long time, it might congeal in some way. But in case of a truck driver, you know, where that truck is constantly in use, no problem. Fill her up. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
You know, I was kind of interesting what you said about the small game license and cat hunting.
Yeah.
I wonder if that license would include, you know, like inner city use, you know, so you could fire your gun in the city, but only if you're aiming at a cat.
I don't think so.
And then where would it stop?
I don't think you're allowed to fire a gun inside the city limits under any conditions.
Yeah, I'm sure if he got the right politician, maybe he'd make the exception. But then you have to wonder where it would stop, you know. Could you shoot at the dog that's chasing your cat? And
well,
how about the guy that beats his dog with the 2x4? I mean, pretty soon we could actually rationalize murder.
Yeah. Well, in my opinion, sir, that's what that is, rationalizing murder, setting up such a thing where you could shoot at cats. Yes, I used the right word, murder. Well, you can't murder an animal. Well, I think you can. It has been my considered opinion for a very, very long time that cats and dogs and other animals as well, mammals, have souls. If we have souls, then I think they have souls. If we don't have souls, then I suppose they don't have souls. Or maybe they have souls and we don't. I don't know. Honestly, all fun aside, I think that most attributes that you can give to a human, minus the speech part, of course, you will see in animals if you live with them closely. You will see personality traits that are undeniably human-like. Jealousy, anger, joy, curious, being curious, awareness of self. I have seen all of these things. And so what constitutes a soul? Well, some would say self-awareness. Some would say some of these other emotions that I talked about. These are all the things that come together to make a human. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art. I'm very glad to be able to talk to you.
Well,
I really enjoy the program you and George have going on there.
Thank you. It is a little different, isn't it?
It is very interesting. It's most interesting. I stay awake till you guys go off at night just to be able to listen to you. I got a couple little things, if you don't mind. One was about Willie Nelson with his diesel fuel.
Yes.
About probably 15, 20 years ago, would have to be a little bit longer than that because I lived in Kentucky at the time, I had a rubber neoprene hose on my transmission line.
Right.
And I lived in a very rural area in West Virginia, Kentucky area down there right on the line. And they had no transmission fluid. So I put me a quart of vegetable oil in it. I never had a lick of problems out of that car and nothing at all. And it worked just as good as trans fluid would work.
Now, isn't that something?
It's really amazing how stuff like that. I figured, you know, it's some sort of oil. So I figured, what the heck, you know. I had to get it home anyway, and it worked.
Well, with my luck, I would have done something like that, and I would have gone to the mechanic, and he'd say, well, I'm sorry, Art, you've done $4,000 worth of damage.
Worth of damage.
But you're saying it works just fine, huh?
Yeah, it worked perfectly. You couldn't even tell no difference. Another little thing I wanted to say, too, is I was talking to my brother today, and I've been thinking about this every time I hear a lot of your programs on here. Back probably 10 years ago, he had surgery on his back, and he was in the hospital, so I'd called him and see how he was doing and stuff. And when he moved to answer the phone, he broke his stitches loose, and he started bleeding. He says, Paul, he says, by the way, my name's Paul. I'm from Detroit area. And he says, Paul, he says, I'm bleeding really bad. Blood squirting all across the room. I said, well, man, holler for a nurse real quick. And he says, a few seconds later, he says, I see Mommy. Her mom had passed away in 1980, and he said he seen Mommy sitting there and was just there. And I asked him about that again today, and he said, oh, yeah, I remember that as plain as day. And I just wanted to mention that to you, that the spirits are out there.
But maybe it's just that we have to reach a certain condition to see them. In his case, he was losing blood rapidly, and who knows what kind of condition he was really in. I don't know. I guess that takes me, in a way, back to last night's program, doesn't it? And the nature of the soul and all these metaphysical things that seem to go on. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. How you doing?
Okay.
This is Suleiman from Vancouver.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I wanted to make mention over the fact that the scenarios that are happening across the United States and the world were the number four is starting to arise, especially in cases with Brian Nichols and the RCMP officers that were killed in Alberta.
What's special about four?
Well, just before the 9/11 incident in 2001, over a six-month period, there were similar situations that occurred in the United States where there were murder situations of accidental death, but the number four kept coming up, and it's a demonic number. And it has to do with something that is about to happen, and I believe it's going to happen either with North Korea or China, where both countries have nuclear weapons. And if we go to war with them, I believe that the possibility of Los Angeles being at ground zero is a reality.
Well, I hope not. A lot of my friends are in Los Angeles, and I would hate to see them be at ground zero. I do wonder about Taiwan and what would occur if, well, you know what, it seems like it's about to occur. Are we going to go to the aid of Taiwan? If Taiwan pushes on this independence, China has just had this really democratic vote. Let me read that again. That was great. I sort of just stumbled across that as I was reading, and here we go. You ready? They just had a vote in China. This is a vote to go to war, should Taiwan continue to press for independence. The vote was 2,896 to zero, with two abstentions. You've got to wonder what's happened to the abstentions. They're probably not well right now. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
Dennis Wolf calling, last name.
I can barely hear you, sir. Turn your radio off, please.
Thank you.
Yes.
This is Dennis calling from Pleasanton, Ohio.
Yes, Dennis.
And I'm calling a little bit in reference to last night and the sonic booms that were heard in the Midwest.
Yes, I got an email about that, yes.
Okay, did you get one from me? Probably did.
I would imagine I did, sir. I get, if you knew how many emails... Anyway, I get a lot of email.
Okay, this is my first time calling. I've been listening to you for many, many years.
Did you hear the sonic booms?
Yes, I did.
Did they figure out what they were?
I have no idea. First, I thought it was thunder, but then I got thinking, no, there's not there to be thundering. I live in Northeast Ohio, and I'm thinking, what is this thunder? And I didn't really put sonic booms to it until the fella contacted you about having sonic booms in Washington or Oregon.
Yeah, well, actually, also across the Midwest, very close to you. So a lot of strange things going on lately. A very great deal of volcanic activity, earthquake activity, magma moving beneath the ground. And earthquakes sort of a threatening. And then we've got these eggs apparently going berserk at Princeton. I wonder if that's real. I'd like a check on that. Any of you have access to the information? Fast blast me what you know. From the high desert in the middle of the night, you're listening to Coast AM.
Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning, everybody. Open lines right now. Anything you want to talk about, absolutely fair game. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to find out about all this shaking and magma and tectonic activity. Jim Berkland's going to be here. So if you've been wondering what's going on, the wait will be but a small one. All right, let's rock and roll. First time caller line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning, Robert.
Hi.
That bill about the cats.
Oh, the
cat. We're talking about mostly a feral cats, barn cats.
Really, and just out of curiosity, I take it you're in favor of it.
Oh, I may be.
Yeah. How do you tell the difference between, and you know,
at a distance, sir.
Wait till I ask the question. At a distance, how do you know it's a feral cat?
Well, you're not supposed to shoot anything with a collar on it. That's in the bill.
Well, I know, but a lot of house pets don't necessarily have collars.
What are you doing shooting near a house?
I beg your pardon?
You shouldn't be shooting anywhere near a house. You should.
I didn't say anything about a house, sir. I just said a lot of cats don't have collars, even ones that are out wandering around. They could still be house pets.
Well, yeah, I understand. And I do understand that, and I feel bad
for you. Well, then if you understand that, then how could you possibly be in favor? You could be shooting people's pets.
I'll tell you that.
How about feral dogs?
Shoot it.
You shoot them, you're saying?
Yeah, I would.
You'd shoot feral dogs, and you'd shoot feral cats.
Yes, I would. And I can tell you why on the cats especially.
Why any more the cats than the dogs?
Well, the more of the cats is because we've done, our own DNR has done studies about it. And your
DNR, what's that?
That's our Department of Natural Resources.
In all right, where are you?
I'm in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. All right. I see. All right. Oh, that's where the bill is too. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Well, your little house cat, you got to look at it. It's a cat.
Yeah.
Whether it's your little house cat or a big lion, they're pretty much the most successful predator on the planet. And they kill more small games than any other natural predator out there combined.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's really what's at the heart of it.
But really at the heart of it is that you couldn't know if you were shooting a house cat or a house cat that got out or a feral cat. And if you can't tell me, you can tell the difference at a distance. You just can't.
Again, it's up to the owner of the cat to make sure it has a collar on it.
Well, I suppose.
That's no different than any leash law.
Then you should be in favor of shooting feral anythings.
I'm not saying that, Art.
Well,
just,
what about...
I just wanted you to understand where
what about those
from.
Poor damn worms? I mean, the birds are... Do you know how they suck up those worms, sir? I mean, they slaughter worms by the millions. All right, goodbye. Jeez. Figure somebody's going to call in favor of that right away. Wildcard line, rather. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Bell. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right.
Okay, good deal. Listen, I was wanting to know about the Princeton eggs. I hadn't really heard any specific details. I've just heard loose mentionings of it here and there. What exactly kind of eggs are they?
Okay. They call them eggs. They're really just computers. And these computers are scattered around the world at tons and tons of different locations. And these computers are all spitting out random numbers. And when these numbers stop becoming so random, alarm bells go off. And when a lot of the eggs start reporting non-random numbers, big alarm bells go off. And they've got a long history now of, you know, the earthquake and then tsunami produced a gigantic off-the-chart result, as did 9/11, other big world events. Interesting thing, sir, that it went off the chart anywhere from an hour to 30 minutes to 3 hours before the event happened.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Yes.
And also, if you could, if it's convenient for you, you could ask the guest about the volcanoes. I would try to call in, but calling in later on in the evening would be near impossible. Is there any way that a volcanic eruption could be prevented? Because volcanic eruption, is basically when the magma builds up and it can't stand the pressure anymore, right?
Well, I had an idea, personally. In fact, actually, I've got two ideas that I'd like to run by people tonight. One concerned volcanoes, and that was when you had a volcano and you could tell from the seismic readings that there was magma moving around, why couldn't you take a man-made drilling team up there? This is going to be a very stupid idea. And drill a hole into the side and let the magma out slowly.
No, that was what I was calling you to have you ask him. Is there any way that we could allow the magma, instead of it blowing the top off everything, just let it seep out in a controlled manner?
Really? You were going to ask that? Well, I will ask Jim Berkland tonight. I'm sure he will chuckle at me and say, well, exactly like you just did.
No, actually, it's a very, very interesting idea. I wonder if there could be any way of doing it, because I think that would be preferable to having...
An explosion.
An explosion, right.
Yes, yes. I'm with you all the way, sir. I thought of this some time ago and suggested it on air. And I have another idea I'd like to run by everybody tonight, perhaps equally as unworkable, I don't know. But this involves suicide bombers, or homicide bombers, or people with dynamite and C4 and stuff like that strapped to their chest. I really would like to run this by all of you. Now... This comes from the mind of an amateur radio operator. I'm a ham operator, right? But I think a lot of you are going to be able to perhaps, maybe, resonate with this idea. How many times have you driven by a highway location where they're doing construction work, building a bridge or, you know, whatever the people who work on our highways do. You know, a lot of times they'll tunnel through mountains and, you know, when they do, they have explosives on the site. They've got a lot of dynamite or whatever it is they use to, you know, blow the rocks out of the way so they can get a road through. Inevitably, you will see signs on the highway that say, no two-way radio use. Am I right? Have you ever seen those? Turn off all two-way radios and communication devices, and you know why? Because they're worried that the RF, the radio frequency, that comes from your transmitter will prematurely detonate the explosives. Now, having said that, and feeling fairly firmly that most of you know what I'm talking about, here's my idea. At American checkpoints in Iraq, before you get anywhere near the American guards and the checkpost itself, you have a very high-energy, wide-spectrum radio transmitter, and you transmit at everybody who walks or rides through. The strength of that radio transmission and the frequency would be adjusted to most likely blow up whatever you've got in your car or strapped on your chest so that not so many people would die, except, of course, the person who chose to actually strap the dynamite on their chest, why they'd go up like a Roman candle. And I just thought I would toss that idea out there and see if it resonated with anybody. What do you think? A very high RF energy signal transmitted toward a potential suicide bomber, not hurting the biological entities, the other ones who walk by it without explosives, but definitely detonating stuff that people are wearing. I wonder if that's a good idea. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. It's Karina calling from Los Angeles. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. You know, I just wanted to comment on a feeling that I had on 910. It was about 9 in the morning. I was on the freeway in L.A. driving to a dentist appointment, and I just had this weird feeling that something was going to go wrong, like it was going to be the end of the world. I don't know. I mean, it was the worst feeling I've ever had in my life, and I've never had that type of a feeling.
Yeah, actually, I think it would have been already underway at 9 o'clock.
It was on 9:10. It was the day before 9/11.
Oh, the day. I'm sorry, on 9:10. Okay.
The morning before. And I wish I had a cell phone at that time. I wish I had had an
ejector.
Well,
let's say you had a cell phone. Who would you have called, and what would you have said?
I was going to call my mom and just tell her, if you're going to go out today, just watch out. I don't know why I'm telling you this. Just be careful. And she's like 2,000 miles up north. So I just had this feeling that I wanted to get out of my car, or I wanted to drive back home and not go to the dentist. It was the worst feeling. And I was looking at other people in their cars thinking, why doesn't anybody feel this? And they're all just driving along, not realizing what's going on. But I just wanted to, like, beam me up. That's the best way I could explain it.
Got it, hon. Well, listen, but you're not the only one. And obviously a lot of people had these feelings cross their consciousness or perhaps their unconsciousness. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people had these feelings. And that's mirrored in the fact that the charts just went off the scale in the Princeton experiment prior to 9/11, as well as so many other large events. And once again, if any of you have access to the current Princeton information, I would be very interested. Are we, in fact, undergoing some big spike now? First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, Mr. Hubbell, how are you doing?
Quite well, sir.
Good. Say, I just wanted to comment on last night's program.
Yes.
With the soy diesel.
Yes.
I am a farmer, and I just wanted to really thank you for your program last night and kind of getting the word out on soybean diesel, which I produce.
You're very welcome, sir. I mean, suppose it really happened and truckers across America began using soybean fuel for diesel. Yes. How much difference would that make to you and to the rest of our country's farmers?
It would be absolutely huge due to the fact that Argentina and Brazil, within the next, I would guess, 4 to 5 years, are going to be the king soybean producers. You know, they're going to be the main soybean producers. So if we can find a whole other use for biodiesel and soybeans, that would be huge to not only the American farmer, but to the rest of the population as far as price of fuel and other products that can come from soybeans.
Then I can't think, then why not do it? And as I told Willie Nelson last night, maybe we have a chance right here and now to talk to the truckers out across America, and there are these certain locations where this soybean fuel, that's right, from soybeans, can be put directly into your standard diesel engine with no modification, no changes whatsoever, and there are certain locations where you can actually get this fuel now and give it a try. You don't have to change a thing. Just fill her up and go. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello. Hello?
Is that me?
That's you, yes.
Great. I was just curious about, you always have these people on who believe in God and everything else. Why are they so afraid to let this woman in Florida die?
Who believe in God and everything else?
Well, you know, the higher power, the God, the Bible.
Uh-huh. You don't believe in any of that, huh?
No, I really don't.
You just think what? There is absolutely nothing?
Well, you know, they had this story that came out earlier this week that the earlier Greek Bible that came was written in, what, 184, something like A.D., is being put back together. There's now books of Mark that were never written. They were written for political use at the time, or being put back together.
I think that there was a lot of political input, shall we say, to what was written in the book.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been changed, it's been altered.
But I'm far from confident that there's absolutely nothing beyond us. And I mean really far from, in fact, quite to the contrary. I think it's more likely there is some intelligent force beyond ourselves.
Hmm. I guess I don't see it, and all I see, I mean, you hear about people in churches shooting each other.
Oh, yes.
And it happens over and over again, and I guess, you know, church people and guns should stay away from each other, but I'm sort of making a joke there, but
it's not much of a joke, really. It's and what's even worse is, as I noted as I read it, that we're all beginning to get sort of immune to hearing those kinds of things. You know, somebody walked into a church today and killed X number of people. Oh, yeah, another church, huh? Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Hey, Art, how you doing this morning?
I'm all right, sir. Where
this
are
is
you?
This is your fireworks buddy in Columbus, Georgia. How you doing?
Great.
You know, technology's gotten now to where it's pretty hard to blow things up with radio waves. I think years ago the blasting caps they were using were really CB, more in that megacycle range.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm sure that the military could study what would blow up current explosives.
You know, sir, they're already using that in Iraq now. But see, mostly the IEDs in Iraq now are being used by what was cellular telephones.
Uh-huh.
You see? And that's in the, if I'm not mistaken, that's in the 800 megahertz range. Is that correct?
Well, late 800, 900 meg.
Well, anyway, let me get back. I've got some friends in China right now.
Then also 1.9. There's two ranges that are currently being
used. Yeah, the digital and the analog.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But look here, I've got some friends in China right now. And they have been kind of advised to get back into the bigger cities instead of out into little factories.
Oh, really?
Yes. And a couple of my buddies are in Taiwan right now. But I don't believe, I really don't believe anything's going to happen because that's just too much money, and China wants their money too much right now.
Well, I hope you're right, but the vote is a little unnerving. China seems entirely fixated on not allowing Taiwan any sort of independence, and of course you would expect the kind of vote we got here, but they seem very determined. First time caller line, you are on the air. Good morning. Hello?
Hello, Art?
Yes.
Are we on the air right now?
Right now.
Okay, well, sorry about that. I wanted to comment on a couple things, but I wanted to answer your what you were talking about, that radio signal at the people.
Yes.
The reason they have you turn off your radios and stuff is because they, some of the detonators they use work
yes.
on radio signals, but you can't just detonate an explosive unless it has that detonator.
Well, it may well be, sir, that some types of microwave might at some power levels. Who knows?
It sets off the detonator. That's why they don't want you doing it.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Okay, agreeing or not on the shooting the feral cats and the dogs is what I'm talking about. I just want you to understand something. They already shoot free-ranging dogs.
Well,
several states, and the only thing that kept me from being in the pen over murder was this pissant little sheriff came in and threw the collar down in front of my kid and said, "I just shot your dog." He was down there running with coyotes. Well, he had a big old red stick hound, and the red stick hound was just a big old dumb pup, and then coyotes, females, came in heat, and he was down running through the brush.
Well, I would ask you the same thing I asked the man with the cat. At a distance, how would you know the difference between a feral dog and a...
He answered your question. You just didn't want to hear it. I'm not for it or against it. I'm against it, okay?
Well, if I didn't hear wait a minute. Hold on, sir. Hold on. If he answered the question and I didn't hear it, and you're right...
I said you didn't want to hear it.
Okay, you give me the answer.
All right. If you see, the reason that you're a gentle person and you don't know anything about killing varmints, those guys use high-powered rifles with fancy scopes, and they can tell you if the cat even has claws if he rolls over on his back. I mean, that's how you would know if he had a collar on. And what they wanted to do was make a thing
but
in their
But, sir, no, you wait. I said the same thing to that other man,
yeah,
and that is, not all house cats or pets
I know,
have collars.
You didn't let him fit. You didn't listen to what he said.
Well, let
they
me hear you.
To make part of that law. They'll make part of that law that you have to have a collar on your cat. I'm not arguing for it. Don't get me wrong. I'm trying to answer your question for you.
Yeah. In other words,
if you don't have a collar, your cat's dead.
Okay. In other words, either have collars on your cats or expect them to be shot.
That's exactly what they're going to say. I've been through this before. The only reason I didn't kill that cop is because I wasn't there. I was gone. He walked in through that collar down at my kid. I'd have shot him when he turned around. Blew him away because he killed my kid's dog and there was no need for it.
Yeah.
But he could, and he wanted to do it because he was a mean sucker and he didn't like it. He didn't like my kids.
All right.
We were in Wyoming.
All right, listen,
know?
I'm losing you, and anyway, I got to go because we're out of time.
All right, bud.
All right, take care. Shooting cats and dogs. And oh yeah, we can tell the difference, because the law would be that you'd have to have a collar, and if it didn't have a collar, that would make it fair game to be shot. Really bad idea. From the high desert, in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
At area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and I keep using this bumper music so that Phil Henry's parodies of me will continue to be contemporary in nature. Good morning, everybody. Jim Berkland, geologist Jim Berkland, as many of you know, or some don't, was suspended from a California government geology job when he made a prediction that he shouldn't have made. A major quake would occur during the 89 World Series while it happened, remember? And then they thanked him. They suspended him. It hit. Government told him, don't make any more predictions. Now he's retired. He publicly states quake windows. Mr. Berkland uses tidal flooding tables based upon lunar perigee, the time when the moon is closest to the Earth, to affect more gravitational pull on the Earth. And I've got, you know, that caller and myself about 2 weeks ago both had the same idea. Jim Berkland would be exactly the guy to ask about it, and we shall in a moment. Couple of ways to open a bottle of champagne, right? One is, and then, of course, you get champagne everywhere. And another is to just open it a little bit, and you get... Right? Now, I know this is probably a crackpot idea, no doubt, but... This call, 2 weeks ago, I mentioned this myself, and this caller just mentioned it as well. With respect to volcanoes and the dome of the volcano, we get stories constantly about the dome of a volcano growing X number of inches or feet or whatever it's done, you know, bulging. And both that caller and myself think that, well, why not send some kind of a drilling team up to the dome of a volcano and drill a hole and let it go tss, you know, and prevent an explosion. Now, that's probably a crackpot idea, but it seems like it ought to have some merit, maybe, except for the guys probably drilling the hole. Jim, what about that?
Well, good to talk to you again, Art.
Yeah, good to have you.
Yes. You know, when you drill down into magma, that is fluid.
Right.
And if you provide an exit for it, it will come up and flow out. And
oh, right.
And it won't be relieving much gas pressure, this tremendous gas pressure down there.
So you couldn't relieve that gas?
It's very, very little. It'll plug itself up. You know, it cools down, and once it gets up, and it chills like the lava tubes.
Mm-hmm.
They chill all around the outside, and the inside it will continue to flow a bit.
So drilling into a dome would not be a good idea.
Well, they do it in Iceland, some places where they actually produce heat, and of course I'm only about 20 miles away from where they're drilling above a magma chamber and generating a lot of geothermal energy.
So you could do it for that reason, but again, not to relieve the pressure that would cause a dome to blow up.
No, that's asking a little bit too much out of mankind.
Too bad. Okay, so look, there's a lot going on. God, there's a lot going on geologically. Seismically, in the world right now, I almost don't know where to begin, but I guess I'd like to begin, if you don't mind, with what's going on off the coast of Oregon?
And Washington.
In Washington, yes.
Yes. Well, there we have a classic ridge where new magma is coming up from deep down below the mantle, and it chills in the big crack along the ridge, and it wedges apart the pre-existing chilled rock of the oceanic plate.
So it's coming up under the water, right?
Yes.
And
often it forms pillows, and it'll chill down there. But when it hardens, it sort of shoulders aside the pre-existing chilled crust, and that's what makes it move laterally. It moves the ridges are almost north-south, and so they move everything west and east. And the part that goes west pretty soon goes down in the Cascadia Trench off the coast of Oregon, Washington, and Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it moves, it makes a quake. And every time it moves, it generates friction. And that helps to melt rock down at larger depths, especially with all that water in there and the soil and the clays that are going down in the marine sediments.
Well, Jim, they were getting thousands of earthquakes. That seemed rather upsetting.
Yes, except that's the nature of the beast. That's what's happening all along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the East Pacific Rise. We're all, remember, all these strange critters are living down there.
Yes.
Those smokers.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that's going around every place they look at. In those active ridges, they're finding things like that. And it's, there are many, most of the volcanoes in the world are under the ocean.
But what's the possibility of this being some sort of precursor to an event that, from a human point of view, might not be so welcome?
It doesn't look like we're going to have a big Atlantis-type thing that they talk about, like we had a Krakatoa. Because it is a spreading ridge, and it sort of accommodates. Like they've taken the little submarine Alvin right down into the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and observed the magma flowing there when it gets to the surface. It's lava. But there will be occasional volcanic peaks and seamounts out there. And it may well be that it could even reach the surface. We know that off Hawaii is growing all the time, and now this new island, Lauihi, is forming over the southern shore just beyond the big island of Hawaii.
How big is it yet?
Oh, it's up to within a few thousand feet of the surface, I think 3,000 or 4,000 feet of the surface. But a couple of years ago, they had hundreds of quakes of 3 and 4 magnitude, and that was another rapidly building time. They think it'll be another 5,000 years or so until it reaches the surface.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
5,000 years, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, meanwhile, the Big Island is the only island of the Hawaiian chain that's still growing because it's active volcanoes, and I was able to stick my geologic pick into a flowing lava flow there about 3 years ago, one of a geologist's big dreams to be able to do that. And but it's a little different over in Hawaii where the volcanism is a little more under control, more fluid lava. It's not so explosive. So you can go right up to the lava flows and see where the margins chilled.
So you actually did that, huh, into
yeah.
hot lava?
Yes.
What was that like? I mean, is it intensely hot as you're getting close enough to put a pick in?
Oh, no, usually not, because it's already got a skin on it in most places. But where it suddenly breaks open and another little bulge comes out,
yes.
You want to back up from that.
Uh-huh.
But, it was pretty exciting. Something I always wanted to do.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be fun to me, too.
Yeah.
Okay, now, of course, now we had St. Helens burp pretty hard the other day, too.
Yes, the strongest since 1980. I was up on the mountain. They were doing a television show called The Invisible, Earthquakes and Volcanoes, some show from back in the Boston area, the educational TV. And I had the last part of the section on earthquakes, and I was waving my arms over the Calaveras Fault and telling about how it was due to go, and it did in a couple months. But as they were folding up the cameras, the director said, "Jim, speaking of other things, what do you think about Mount St. Helens?"
Right.
Now, this was March 27, 1980, and on March 20th, the strongest quake on the whole West Coast was a 4.3 right under Mount St. Helens. And then there were a couple of other smaller quakes during the week. And so on the 27th, when he asked me, "What do I think about it?" I said, "I think that volcano means business. I'd give it a 50-50 chance to erupt this year."
Really?
And become the first one since Mount Lassen to be active on the 48 states. And that was back in 1914 to 1917. So the director said, "I hope you're right, Jim. We're going to go fly around it this afternoon." And when they dropped me off back at the office, I found out that it was beginning to erupt at that very time.
My goodness.
So it was a good time. And 1 week later, I was flying around the peak with KNTV from San Jose and a couple other geologists. And it was all socked in and nothing was happening. And we looked down at Spirit Lake and the mud flows coming down the nice white snow-clad St. Helens. And then we climbed above the clouds, about ready to bid it adieu, and suddenly it began to erupt. And we stayed for another 15, 20 minutes shooting all of our film, and it was great chunks of ice were being thrown up in the air from the glacier, and there's boiling black clouds, and it was just really thrilling.
That must have been. It really must have been. Are there any expectations with regard to Mount St. Helens? We had the big one. Now we just had this pretty recent, pretty big one. Not as big as the original, of course.
Well, the original, yeah, of March 27th, this one actually exceeded that one. But the big blow of May 18th.
Right.
Yeah, nothing.
So when I talk about expectations, I mean, is there pressure being relieved now, and so the worry about a larger event is less?
I don't think so. It didn't turn out to be true last time. We had three or four fairly good eruptions before the big blast. We're going to have to see whether the heat flow is continuing and the tilt of the southern slope is continuing.
So the odds are not lower that it could still really blow.
Yes. I'm sure they're really instrumenting the heck out of it. They lost some instruments with that last eruption. Now, as far as I was concerned, it was a very timely eruption because my seismic window opened on the 8th and runs through tomorrow, the 15th, and it began to erupt on the 8th. And
are these always predictable, Jim?
Oh, no. Six of the seven in 1980... the major eruptions, I did predict.
I meant by the scientists that have the instruments around these mountains. From that point of view, Jim, are they always predictable, or can it just suddenly happen and all the instruments go berserk at once?
Oh, boy, they usually post-dict them. They tell you after the fact, yep, we knew what that was going. there have been a few cases where you get harmonic tremors. You get continuous earthquakes.
Right.
Without a real clear P wave.
Right, but you're saying sometimes forget the precursors, they don't happen, you just have one big event, boom.
Yeah, that's pretty unusual, though.
Okay.
But in every volcano, every eruption, just like every earthquake, is unique. And so you always are, there's a lot of guesswork involved. But when you see the signs of the tilt and the increasing heat flow, and then the test the gases, and you see which of the gases are most abundant just before an eruption?
Mm-hmm.
They're getting closer, and certainly they're a lot closer to accepting a prediction of volcanic eruptions than they are of accepting prediction of earthquakes. And that's partly, I think, because with magma, you can picture it actually has, it's a fluid, it has a tide in it, and it responds to gravitational pressures from the sun and moon, mainly
sure.
The moon. And we find that there seems to be a kind of a cyclical pattern with many volcanoes. Certainly not all of them, but a few are showing a pretty good fingerprint helping to predict actual eruptions.
Now, I realize that there are seismic readings associated with the movement of magma and volcanoes, but is there any relationship to tectonic activity and volcanic activity?
Big time.
Big time.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, that 9.5 magnitude quake down in Chile in 1960?
Yes.
It had 9 quakes of 7 magnitude or better as aftershocks, and 2 Chilean volcanoes sprang into activity.
Hmm.
And in 1902, Pele had been bulging and steaming and creating a lot of concern down the island of Martinique. But the governor down there was about to have an election, and he didn't want the wealthy people to take off, and so he brought in a French expert who said everything is fine, Pele's fine. Well, 30,000 of them died a few days later. But the animals were fleeing the volcano, and they might also have noticed that the day before it erupted and wiped out all those people with a new AR dot, the glowing avalanche of incredibly hot gases and particles that just cooked everything. The day before, there was an eclipse of the moon. And the day before, about 200 miles to the south, there was another volcanic eruption on another island. And the people on Martinique breathed a sigh of relief and said, boy, that'll take the pressure off. Well, they weren't drilling for that one, but it naturally was in that same belt of the West Indies.
Right.
And because one volcano went off, it didn't relieve Pele.
Isn't that something? How frequently do we see many eruptions around the world at the same time? In other words, the basis of this question is, down deep in the earth, Jim, is there any connection, do you feel, between volcanoes, volcanoes in the Caribbean, volcanoes in the northwest part of the U.S., volcanoes in Japan, volcanoes around the world, are they connected somehow?
Well, there is no central fire. Each volcano has its own little magma chamber. And there is some connection in that they tend to be a linear belt, like the Cascade Range, inland from the Cascadia Trench. And that was something that, you know, they recognized the ring of fire around the Pacific.
Right.
There's a similar ring around much of the Mediterranean. And it's related to plate tectonics and where the plates are moving and where they are underthrusting, where one plate is diving down beneath usually a continental plate. All that friction generates magma, and you get periodic eruptions. And but the, you know, they aren't totally divorced. When Mount St. Helens went off, the big blow in the May 18th.
Yes.
Well, here down in Mammoth Lakes, within a week there were three quakes of over 6.5 magnitude. And then when the big earthquake hit Landers in 1992, down your way.
Right.
There was a rash of quakes at Mammoth Lakes and up at Lassen and up at Yellowstone, small ones. But there was a 5.5 in western Utah and another 5.5 down your way, but down by the deposit, nuclear depository site, where there wasn't supposed to be any 5-magnitude quakes.
Yes, have they, by the way, have they noticed that?
Have they noticed it?
Yes, have they noticed that? you mentioned
they're,
that...
They're trying to keep it quiet, I think. But yes, they have noticed it. In fact, I was rather delighted to hear an expert from the U.S. Geological Survey say after the Landers quake, well, we were a bit surprised that... The action occurred at the Mammoth Lakes in response to that big 7-magnitude quake at Landers because the amount of energy passing through the Mammoth Lakes was less than the energy of the full moon passing overhead.
Mm.
Well, I don't need less than the full moon. I'll just take the full moon.
Oh, I know.
So, you know, they're admitting that these minor forces can trigger activity, seismic activity. We know that on the moon, that there actually are moon quakes, and most of them occur once a month when the Earth and moon are closest.
In other words, the Earth has a similar, perhaps even greater effect on the moon than the moon does on the Earth? Would that be fair? I mean, we have more...
Well, we're 81 times as massive as the moon.
Exactly.
But the moon is dead. It doesn't have really a liquid core or active volcanoes or a moving plate. I made the anomaly, or the analogy, that if you have a 95-year-old man on a cot, bare feet hanging out, and a 12-month-old baby sitting on another cot lying down there, and you tickle their feet with feathers, where are you going to see the action? And I think the youngster, the living body like the Earth, is where you'll see the action from a minor stimulus.
Uh-huh. No doubt. Well, all right. Listen, in a moment, I want to talk to you about animals. I know it's one of your favorite subjects, and I'm getting a lot of emails from people who are saying that their animals are behaving oddly. There's been quite a bit of that in the last few days, so if you will hang on, we'll get back to you, and we'll find out where you are with watching animals and their reaction. I mean, after all, remember the big story about the big quake? The wave? And the animals, not a one of which was found. Remember that? We'll talk about it.
talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Really talking about one of the most scary things in the whole world. Have you ever been in a big earthquake, really big earthquake? There's nothing quite like it. Nothing quite like it in terms of the absolute inability of your mind to deal with how helpless you really are. And then, of course, the quake at Sumatra and the killer tsunami. And, you know, I was reading the stories in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of that, in which people, along with the horrible tragedy, were commenting that not one single animal body was found. It was in all kinds of wire stories. And, Jim, it seems to me that bolsters everything you've been saying about animals, doesn't it?
It certainly caused a lot of communication my way, and a lot of people say, well, maybe there is something to it. Well, it's pretty hard to ignore when they have all these human bodies and no bodies of the large mammals. And there were reports of elephants heading up the hill and
yes,
and all kinds of animals heading up the hill. Also before quakes, there are often mass strandings of marine mammals.
Yes.
And I just uncovered one I'd forgotten all about. Back in late January 1971 was the worst marine mammal stranding in the history of Southern California, with more than 200 dolphins stranded up on San Clemente Island.
Huh.
Less than about 2 weeks before the February 9th quake at San Fernando.
Isn't that something?
And that was on the day of the eclipse of the moon also.
Uh-huh.
So we had the tidal effects, and we had the marine mammals, and then I went back through the old L.A. Times, and sure enough, the missing animals rose abruptly just before that quake and could have been predicted had I been looking at it in those days. And then there was an article on February 10th, the day after the quake, where they were citing the Griffith Park Observatory astronomer, Dr. Kaufman. And he said, I think yesterday's earthquake had something to do with yesterday's eclipse of the moon. Not that it caused the quake, but through extra gravitational stress triggered a weak place in the fault. My idea. Only I didn't get it till 3 years later.
Well, what do you think, Jim, that animals, what's going on here? Are they sensing of something, some vibration? Are they actually having some kind of instinctual, precognitive experience,
you know,
altogether? What do you think?
Okay, we do know that they have the mechanism in their bodies by which they can detect changes in the magnetic field. We know that even people have it, and it wasn't recognized until 1984. I'm talking of the most highly magnetic natural substance on Earth, magnetite.
Magnetite in our brains,
yeah,
right?
304, it's right over our pineal gland, yeah, in the middle of our forehead, and that's where number 14 people, 13 women, one man, have reported to me they get these terrible these headaches. They identify them as earthquake headaches, and
yes,
in the middle of their forehead, and they last for about 3 days before the quake, and then moments before the earthquake, maybe within 30 minutes, the pressure and pain disappear, and they know the quake is imminent.
Well, since these are people and they can talk, maybe
yeah,
we should be corralling all these people
yes,
who have this and keeping track of them.
Yes, and I've had, six or eight of them communicated with me regularly when I was down in San Jose. I'm a little more remote now, still a phone number away, and my website has had 122 million hits on it since the very first time I opened it back in 1997 on the day I was first on your show.
And your website is?
It's Syzygy Job, SYZYGYJOB, my initials, syzygy.com.org.net. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. And if they go to my message board, they will see under seismic sentries about 200 comments about animals just this month. And there's parakeets and dogs and cats and tortoises and ants and, you know.
So then I'm right. There is a lot of activity going on.
Oh, yes.
I'm
yes.
getting the email, so.
Uh-huh. So I certainly encourage people to document these things. There's just no one thing. Oh, it's to call it anecdotes. I'm always accused of talking about anecdotes. Well, when I get the information in advance and publicize it, then it's not an anecdote. It's a fact. It's a scientific fact.
Well, does everything that's going on right now, the emails I'm getting, the activity on your website, does it add up to anything that makes sense?
Well, several things. Back in 1984, I predicted we were going to have a 6-magnitude quake or better in Santa Clara County because of the record rainfall that we had in 1983. The record we broke in San Jose was 1889. Well, on April 24th of 1890, we had a 6.5-magnitude quake.
Yes, sir.
And then we had, of course, the 1906 quake, and then another 6 in 1911, and we didn't have another 6 in the Bay Area until 1984, again on April 24th, following the new record rainfall year. Now we know what's been happening down your way with your blooming desert.
Well, see, now, I was about to ask you about this, Jim. In Las Vegas, we have a TV station. We watched the CBS affiliate in there, and they had some news the other day about the fact that this winter, Jim, we've had more rain than in all the record-keeping ever done by mankind for this area of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that worries me, because if there is a connection to earthquakes, then what does all this rain we've had mean?
Well, there are several things that happen. One thing, a foot of water adds a load of about 1 million tons for every square mile. So you can look at how much of the rain has evaporated, how much of it has run off, and how much of it has accumulated in the water table and in the reservoirs and lakes.
Mm.
And that adds a load to the crust.
Mm.
When they first built Hoover Dam, Boulder Dam in those days, there were a series of earthquakes after a couple of years of filling the reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
And the engineer down there said he thought the earthquakes, which were most unusual, related to the filling of the reservoir, and he was poo-pooed. He went to his deathbed not knowing how right he was. Now, reservoir-induced seismicity is very common. It's accepted when you build a new reservoir, you have to design the dam to withstand the quake that the dam and reservoir might create.
So what you believe is that it is the weight of the water?
That's part of it, and of course, the buildup of the pore pressure. The only thing holding a fault together friction. And if you can inject a little grease, it'll allow it to slip, make an earthquake. And that's all an earthquake is. It's a moving along a fault line. And if friction holds it together, and then it gets a high pore pressure, that allows it to slip prematurely. It would eventually slip anyway.
Okay. The fact that we just had an all-time record rainfall here might mean what?
That you're going to have a pretty good jolt. Now, in 1978, I ran into an article about the earthquake phenomenon, and four scientists from USC had done a study of rainfall in Southern California, and they found an interesting fact that from 1900 to 1972, there had been, I believe, 22 quakes of 6 magnitude.
Yes.
All had been preceded by a year or two of drought, followed by 1 or 2 years of excessively heavy rainfall.
Right.
And that happened again. I went back since 72. Well, it happened before the Landers quake. It happened before the Northridge quake. And several others.
Now, of course, it's not just my area. When you say my area, I assume you're referring to, Southern California.
Yeah.
At the same time, right?
Yeah. It's it's pretty hard. You have to learn from history. You know, I tell people, if you don't know your history, you're history. So it's stupid to ignore what's already happened. And I get people to keep telling me, oh, come on, you're not using enough information. You know, what about the last 1,000 years? And I said, well, I'm not worried so much about the last, you know, the previous 1,000, but I can learn from the last few decades and see what happens. So we're going to have, I think there's going to be a 6-plus in southern Nevada or southern California by this summer.
By summertime.
June, July, and August are extremely high tide periods. And they're called Perigean spring tides. Now, in July 21st, there's a very close approach of the moon on the same day, only 8 hours away from the full moon. And it's also the time of, just past the time of the equinox.
Mm-hmm.
So, three months that I would say is most likely for having a 6-plus in Southern California. Now, last year I was sort of neutral on Vladimir Kalis Borok, the Russian seismologist who was calling for a 6.4 quake down there by September 5th.
Yes.
Of course, it didn't happen.
Right.
And I was most intrigued by what happened to me when I went to a meeting in Oakland discussing his prediction in July.
What happened?
Well, I brought with me several of my predictions of a quake in Japan the previous September and the San Simeon quake, which occurred just hours before the highest possible tides in California. I mean, I'd been warning about December of 2003 all year long. And so then my window opened on the 21st, and the San Simeon quake had on the 22nd, and on the 26th was the Bam Iran quake with some 40,000 people killed. And that was the time of the maximum possible tides and the highest tides we'd experienced since 1986. So such the tides are certainly predictable, and if we find the earthquakes are occurring around the same time, then earthquakes are predictable.
Well, how predictable? No. I mean, to the point where...
Well, that was...
Look, whether you're working with animals, and that seems a valid way to work to me, Jim, or you're working with the tides and the moon and all the rest of it. I mean, can you call... How closely can you call an earthquake? And when is it... How far are we from the point where a county or a state is going to issue some sort of a really official step out on a limb as a result of some of this research and make a prediction?
20 years ago, we thought they were 10 years away.
Yes. Well,
and every year they were saying we're 10 years away, we're a decade away. And I spoke before a scientific body, and I had a clipping in my hand from the Russians saying they thought they were 5 years away.
Right.
And I spread my hands out on the desk, and I leaned over and told all these experts, gentlemen, we have an earthquake prediction gap. Not one of them smiled. Oh, boy. So some people take themselves too seriously. But what I do is say, keep an open mind. If we don't keep an open mind, ears, and eyes, we're not really being scientific. And it always troubled me. I was trained for 10 years in college and university. I taught the universities on the East and West Coast. And was always kind of middle of the road, mainstream scientist. And I didn't think you could predict earthquakes until 1974, when I looked into 6 earthquakes that had greeted me as county geologist for Santa Clara County in late 1973. And all 6 of those quakes occurred at the time of the newer full moon. And I thought, well, this is a preferred time. This is kind of a seismic window, time of high potential for quakes. And I made a prediction on January 8th. Is that we'd have a 4 to 5 magnitude quake in the county, and it happened 2 days later. And I thought, boy, this is simple. What's so tough about predicting earthquakes? And I kept it quiet for a couple of years. When I was asked to speak to the Alumni Scholarship Award-winning ceremony at San Jose State University, they said they couldn't interest the media that I have anything interesting in, well, stimulating and controversial with terms. And I said, well, I have something along that line. It's not ready for publication, but okay, I'll do it. And I didn't realize how effective they were. There were 4 television cameras and 10 reporters with pencils poised to hear me speak and make a prediction, which didn't happen. So I said, call me back in October, and I got a doubleheader on the first day of my window in October on the day of an eclipse of the moon. The USGS said, he's merely matching two random series of events. It's a little better than reading tea leaves, and they haven't changed their opinion ever since. So there are so many things that are happening. The windows, the seismic windows from the tides tell me approximately when. I have an eight-day window associated with those high tides.
But you've got to be able to say where to.
Exactly. And so we look at what happens to the water tables. We look at what happens to radon gas releases, tilt of the ground, magnetic field changes. I have a couple of magnetic stress indicators, north, south, and east, west, and they've often shown anomalous movements. They had, in Alaska, 1964, on the island of Kodiak, they had instrumented with very delicate magnetometers so they could detect what was happening in the ionosphere. And on a normal day, you would see 5 or 10 gamma changes. On this day, on the Good Friday, 1964, in the afternoon, they had saw a change of 100 gammas, and they thought their instrument was defective.
Mm-hmm.
And that afternoon is when Kodiak had a tsunami of about 30 feet, and they had the 8 to 9.2 quake. Now, that quake was on the day of the full moon at the time of the lowest tides for the day. The next 9-magnitude quake was over in Sumatra on Boxing Day, 26th of December, in my on the day of the full moon. Both of those 9-magnitude quakes and the huge destructive tsunamis were on the day of a full moon.
All of this seems very convincing, but if you compile it against earthquakes that have occurred when we don't have full moons or the tides aren't as you've suggested, then what do we come up with?
Well, I've been hitting about 75% now for 30 years.
75%?
Yeah, and chance would allow me 25%. It's just a matter of, let's see, I just now went back through the earthquakes of at least 3 magnitude in the Puget Sound area since the year 2000.
Yes.
As of January 16th of last year, there were 22 quakes in the Puget Sound area of at least 3 magnitude, and 18 of the 22 fit. That is...
That's pretty good.
That's more than the chance rate.
Way above.
Yeah.
Way, way above.
So, and I've been doing that. I've only missed three quakes in the Bay Area of more than 5 magnitude since I moved back to California in 1973. And just most recently, since I came up to live in the Valley of the Moon, we had the Bolinas quake on August 17th of 1999. It happened right after the eclipse of the sun, passed across the Atlantic and over Turkey, and then Turkey had the great earthquake at Izmit.
I recall, yes.
40,000.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The next day we had the 5-magnitude quake over here in Bolinas on the San Andreas Fault.
Right.
Well, that was a pretty good jolt. And then in the year 2000, in September 3rd, we had a 5.2 quake that did $50 million damage in the wine country at Napa. It was only centered about 3 miles from our house. It shook us really violently, but we didn't have any damage here. The energy mainly propagated southward, and we're to the west of the epicenter. But I hit both of those quakes right on the money. I had a TV crew from Great Britain come here, and they said, well, will you give us a specific prediction for our British audience? And I said, well, based on all of these missing animals in the San Jose paper, mm-hmm. the fact that I have 3 days left of my window here, I'm predicting we have at least a 4.5 in the Bay Area within the next 3 days. And they said, fine, thank you. They folded up their cameras, and they went down to San Francisco to spend the night before they headed for Japan to continue their program. That night, a 5.5 shook the heck out of them in San Francisco. So they called me to congratulate me. This happens fairly frequently. And we just had, you were mentioning about animals, for sure.
Yes.
National Geographic flew me up to Seattle back a couple of months ago. It's going to appear on their program here in June. And also another British crew is doing a thing on Animal Planet, and that will also come out in June.
All right. Hold it right there. We'll be right back. Top of the hour. I'm Art Bell with Jim Brooklyn. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Seismically, things are very alive right now. And so our guest is Jim Berkland. And he is famous, or is it infamous, for predicting earthquakes that come true. We'll get back to him in a moment. So many things to talk about with Jim Berkland, but we were with animals, back sort of with the animals for a moment. Jim?
Yo.
How are you going to develop this thing with animals? Are you going to go further with it? I know now you watch, you know, the lost and found, the animals that run away, that sort of thing.
Yes, I have the daily records now since 1979 for a couple of newspapers, and so I can... if a quake comes up, I can demonstrate how the animals showed it before the World Series quake, which I named in the newspaper 4 days before it happened. Instead of having 4 or 5 missing cat ads, we had 27, the all-time record at that point, and we had 58 missing dog ads instead of the normal 15 or 20.
Well, you're doing that for that area, but I mean, if this is an effective method of forecasting earthquakes, then really it ought to be done just about everywhere, shouldn't it?
Well, sure, but I'm just one person. But I did predict a quake up in Seattle, the 5.7 quake on the southwest edge of Puget Sound the day before it happened because there were an extraordinary number of missing animals in the Seattle Times. Back in 1990, I was invited to speak to the Foundation for the Study of Cycles in Irvine, California, on the 25th of February, 1990. And that morning, I pulled out the L.A. Times before my talk and saw 58 missing dogs, and the normal was about 20.
Mm-hmm.
So towards the end of my talk, I said, I want to save time for questions, but I also want to alert you to my concerns here based on this. And I unfolded this long line of missing pets. And I said, based on this and the fact that my window is still open for 3 days, I'm predicting a 5-magnitude quake or greater for the Los Angeles area within 3 days. A fellow in the back of the audience got up and went out the door, and I never saw him again. 10 days later, I got a letter from New York saying, congratulations on another hit. I didn't want to share in it. I checked out of the hotel and took the first plane back to New York. Now, he really took me seriously.
Obviously.
But the Upland quake hit on the 28th, and that did quite a bit of damage about 30 miles north of where I was speaking. Interesting, too, as I was making this talk, it was all videotaped. And during my talk, there was an electronic glitch right across the middle of the screen that they couldn't understand. It didn't happen with any other speaker over 2 days.
Uh-huh.
But it, you know, people say this was just an anecdote. No, I did it in advance, and it's recorded. And just like the newspaper account or any other of these accounts that I give.
Well, yeah, I mean, here you are on national radio. It's you've already made one prediction, sort of a loose one, a 6 quake, I think you said, in my area, meaning Southern California, Southern Nevada,
mm-hmm.
within 3 months.
During the 3 months of summer.
Is there anything else you'd like to predict now and get solidly on the record?
Okay, well, all of my newsletter, and I've been sending out a newsletter monthly since I was on suspension for predicting the World Series quake, and they told me I could only come back to work if I didn't predict any more on county time.
Right.
So I started my newsletter in January of 1990, and my next window, and this window, by the way, is March 8th to 15th, so it closes tomorrow. So what's happened? Just this afternoon, there was a 3.5 down by Palomar.
Yes.
And that was a 100% hit. There was a 3.3 at Olympia, and I set a 3 to a 5, so that was a 100% hit. And I said there would be a 3.5 to 6 in the greater Bay Area, and there was a 4.2 this afternoon over in, I guess it was yesterday, over in Mammoth Lakes. It was 30 miles beyond my 140-mile limit. So I give myself 70 or 80% for that.
Okay.
So anything beyond 30% off in distance would not count, or 3 days off doesn't count, and 3/10 magnitude off wouldn't count. I say I'm off the dartboard in that case.
That's pretty tight.
Yeah. Talk to some of my critics. One critic said 4 minutes off with a quake in Los Angeles a few years ago.
Yes.
That was a total miss. It happened at 11:56, and my window didn't open until midnight. So that's, they want mathematical precision, and
well,
Mother Nature just won't be browbeaten like that.
Yes, of course. But, you know, critics are that way.
I have
critics,
noticed. When I went to that meeting, as I mentioned to Dr. Vladimir Kalis Borok, and listened, and I got up and introduced myself, and said, the title of this meeting is, Have We Turned the Corner on Earthquake Prediction? Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't have to turn the corner because I've been on a straightaway for the last 30 years. Nobody reacted. And I said, the two quakes that Dr. Borok says he predicted and helped to establish this new prediction, I predicted both of those in my newsletter, and I have copies with me of the last, the 8 magnitude over in Japan and the 6.5 in San Simeon. Not one person approached me. And as I tried to hand a few out to people, they avoided me like I had the plague.
Really?
So I realized that's the status of science. Well, by the way, a lot of this may change because at long last there is a book being written about what I've been doing. And it's by author Cal Ori, who's written a lot about animals and has written short stories and items about animals and quakes, and often included me in Cat's World, Dog's World, Women's World. But this is a full-fledged book. And it's going to come out in December, and we will be distributing it at a table at the American Geophysical Union.
I wonder how that'll be accepted.
We shall find out.
You think more of the same?
No, because the scientists are one thing, and the people are something else. I have received thousands of letters, only one unfavorable letter in all the ones I've received. My first time on your show, I offered people a free newsletter.
That's right.
Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and you said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yeah, sure."
That's right.
I got 4,000, and I spent the next 3 months tearing open letters and stuffing newsletters for people.
Well, I'm good at predicting that kind of stuff. yeah. Listen, there's something on the Drudge Report that I'd like to call your attention to if you haven't seen it. It's a picture of the top of Kilimanjaro. It says, the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro, as it has not been seen for 11,000 years, developing. What's that all about?
Well, apparently the global warming is happening. It's just not necessarily man-caused, but no question that we're losing a lot of ice. And we had a warmer period than this when the Vikings were going, my heritage, back in 800 to about 1200. It was warmer than today.
Mm.
That's why they settled on Iceland and Greenland and Vinland.
Well, surely when you look at the North Pole and you look at the South Pole and what's going on at both those places,
sure,
particularly up at the North Pole, and look at pictures separated by 40 or 50 years, it's really freaky. I mean,
yeah,
you know, 40% of the ice or whatever gone on the way to becoming a new sea that will be navigated by our Navy.
Yes. Well, I guess Hemingway would have to rewrite his Snows of Kilimanjaro, huh?
Yes, apparently. That's incredible.
Yes.
Absolutely incredible. All right. Under the category, Jim, of how many died, when we have these earthquakes around the world and these tsunamis, the number of victims, the number of people that die, seems really hard to track. I mean, they always start off with very few, and it's always a minimized story, and then by the time it's done, you're up to 100,000 people or something. How frequently are we being lied to, do you suppose, about how many people are killed in these?
About 90% of the time.
That's a lot of the time, Jim.
Yes. Well, I discovered in 1979 about the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. I often raise the question, gee, we got awfully lucky. They're only losing a few hundred, 452 or 315 or 277. Various experts came up with different numbers, almost all less than 500 for San Francisco.
That's right.
And they said, well, absolutely, the fire did most of the damage, and people just moved out ahead of the fire. You didn't expect them to wait around. Well, I did if they were crushed under the buildings. The temperatures of that fire 2,500 degrees because cast iron melted. And, radiators and kegs of nails retained the shape of the keg, and the wood was all gone, the nails fused together. It takes 2,500 degrees. I checked with a crematory, and they only use 1,800 degrees. So there was very little to clean up. So the Army, the early estimates by the Telegraph Company and General Funston were about 3,000 killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then General Greeley came out quickly to take over, and the Secretary of Commerce and Labor, Metcalf, was a direct emissary from Teddy Roosevelt, and they all had their act together. It's just like you recorded. There has been much exaggeration of the death. The true total is, and pick a number from around 250 to 450. And people didn't want to deal with it because the Army had everything in control, and they claimed there hadn't been anybody shot for looting, except one accidental one. Lies, lies, lies. And so I ran into an article in Great Disasters of the World by James Cornell, and it said that in 1968 this major quake hit Iran, and that at least 6,000 people died. There were reports that more than 18,000, but the truth will not be known because the reluctance of the Iranian government to admit to shoddy construction. I read that and said, that sounds logical. And then I read a British almanac, 1907, which said, last April 18th, San Francisco was visited by a frightful earthquake, caused more than 60 million pounds damage. Now, $5 a pound in those days, 300 million, not too far off the real damage. But more lamentable was the loss of several thousand lives. Oh, my hackles rose on seeing that. What are these British mean telling us? Lost several thousand when I know for a fact it was only a few hundred. Come on. What do you think we are, a third world country? I was very provincial.
I really have wondered about this tragedy toll that we get.
Mm-hmm.
It seems so strangely released. And
yes.
Sumatra, for example, I wonder what is real there.
Well, in my newsletter in January, I estimated 400,000 killed and would die with the disease and all. The highest total I've seen now is about 300,000, but it's slowly climbed. It's still occurring. People are even killing each other. It's a desperate situation, and maybe one of the world's greatest disasters. And they said the tsunami first reported about 30 feet, and now they found debris up on 80-foot trees.
Oh, my God.
It was up to 80 feet in places.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And one of the most incredible things is a leading geologist whom I've met and did a lot of work on the San Andreas Fault. I didn't know he had worked 10 years in Sumatra. He was spending his own money distributing 5,000 posters and talking to churches and schools and trying to acquaint people to the threat of a big quake and tsunami. This is last year in July.
I think I'd heard about this.
Well, and I've been trying to include him in my book. Cal's been trying to get hold of him, but I don't know if he's been told to be quiet or what. But,
well, I've heard about this, that he was distributing all kinds of warnings.
Yes, and he had a meeting set up with some of the governmental leaders a couple of weeks before the event, and then they decided they didn't have enough money to travel, and they canceled it. But he did about what I did before the World Series quake. I took matters in my own hands because most of the media outlet didn't want to hear about that I'd been working with earlier.
Well, you must have known when you did that, Jim, that yes. you were doing a potentially career-ending thing.
It didn't end my career, but...
You had to look at it that way before you did it. That had to be one of the things that you considered.
Definitely.
You know, the fallout.
I said, am I going to conform or am I going to inform?
Yes. Well,
and when if somebody had the clue to for AIDS or something, you have to come out with it. And I just don't believe in censorship. I was very fortunate as county geologist. There was only one time before the World Series earthquake where I was censored, and I was told to not talk about the threat of mudslides following the big forest fire we had in 1985. And I talked to the sheriffs and the forest service and the various homeowners, and finally I got the word from the boss, Jim, some of the real estate people are concerned it might affect property values.
Oh.
So we don't want you to talk about the potential for mudflows. Well, we had extremely heavy rainfall and everything that I said happened. And so I got...
I was going to ask, what would the motive be for trying to shut you up, and you just told me.
Yeah, that's the same thing with the deaths in 1906. The insurance company said they weren't going to pay for any earthquake damage because nobody had any earthquake insurance. So early estimates of 50-50% went down to 95% fire and 5% earthquake. And all the old-timers through history called it the fire, not the earthquake. And only in recent years, the city historian, Gladys Hansen, was doing the same thing I was simultaneously. Back in the late 70s. She started after Roots appeared on television, and she was getting all these wires and phone calls from people all around searching for Aunt Gertrude. She'd look for Aunt Gertrude on the death list and the missing list, and she wasn't there. And so she realized eventually that there was a third list of those that never had been followed up upon. So in 1989, she and the former fire chief wrote a big card table book, picture book, wonderful pictures that they had on file with the fire department. And it's called Denial of Disaster. And in there she said at least 3,000 killed. Well, I've been saying 5,000 to more than 10,000 from 1979. And now it's starting to appear in some of the official books. But for many, many years, the World Almanac would say 452 dead.
See, it just doesn't seem as though 2,000 people or 3,000 people could be missing for that period of time without somehow somebody realizing that that's how they died and they're getting added to the death toll.
Well, just picture if you live in another part of the country and your relative's visiting out here and they disappeared, you don't know what to do.
Right.
How do you follow up? And you get denials from everywhere. Well, they'll show up, or maybe they'll get back to you, and then time passes.
And they don't.
No. And I found a similar... Now, had I been the county or city geologist for San Francisco, and I hear Mayor Schmitz, Governor Pardee, or Teddy Roosevelt say, Jim, terrible disaster, do you think it could happen again in another 10 years? No. 50 years, not likely. 100 years, maybe. Well, it's a long time away, and we have to look to the present and to the living. We have to rebuild. We have to encourage reinvestment. It's the leading military, social, economic center of the West Coast. You've got 450,000 people lived in San Francisco, only 250,000 in Los Angeles at the time. So I would have agreed to a time capsule, you know, in 20 years, 30 years, let the truth come out so we can prepare for the next one. What's the greater good, to keep it quiet for a while so that we can? Absolutely, the investors back east said no more. They had the big quake in 1892 and 1865 and 1868.
Right.
Right on down, so good money after bad. And people could accept fires because they had the big one in Chicago and Baltimore. And best-run city can have a fire. So they focused on the fire and absolutely minimized the deaths. And that happened many, many other times in many other places. And I've started, you normally see, you can graph it. It starts low, as you were saying, and then it steadily increases day after day, and then finally it gets sort of asymptotic. It kind of flattens out. Well, in the case of San Francisco, it started very high, and then we ended up very low. It made a big L. And totally unrealistic. It hasn't happened, you know, you don't see patterns like that.
There's something weird with these death tolls. Jim, hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. Jim Berkland is my guest, and we're talking about the earth below us, the earth we all walk on. Have you ever been in a really big earthquake? As I said earlier, it is the most hard-to-deal-with event you'll ever go through, because you have totally, absolutely no control over it whatsoever. None. It's going to happen to you.
Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning. Jim Berkland is here. He predicts earthquakes. That's something a geologist is not supposed to do. Actually, maybe it is something a geologist is supposed to do. Maybe we ought to have a different way of thinking of about that whole thing. What do you suppose? I am kind of a quake watcher, and of course I get communications, thank God, from all of you out there. And as a result, I'm aware of most quakes that occur, and certainly the unusual ones that occur. And Jim, lately I've been getting emails from people, and there are quakes going on at the North Pole.
Yeah, Severnaya Zemlya.
Yeah. How unusual are quakes at the North Pole?
They're pretty unusual, just like at the South Pole. We finally had a few years ago, there was an 8-magnitude quake way down near the Antarctic continent, which was almost unique. But most of the action is, you know, in the temperate zones and from there south.
The middle zones, right?
Yeah.
So if we do start having a lot of quakes at the pole, is there something about that that should concern us?
Well, I haven't really seen, you know, just an occasional one. I haven't seen a concentration of them up at the extreme latitudes. But if we did, then that would, you know, cause some additional concern about the magnetic fields. And
yes.
And I worked, the first work I had with the USGS was in paleomagnetic studies of the western lava flows. And back in the late 50s, they still thought they could explain the variations by changes, by polar wandering, that the magnetic field would wander, and they didn't accept plate tectonics. That was really not born officially till 1969.
Right.
So things change. I had to unlearn an awful lot of facts. But I have said, finally, when I teach, I say a scientific fact is at best a progress report subject to change with some new insight or some new data.
Yes. Another area I want to ask you about is the sun. I watch the eruptions on the sun, and
yeah,
of course it has 11-year or 22-year cycles, depending on how you want to look at it. And I have, because of my hobby with ham radio, I've watched solar cycles very carefully and might see some correlation with what goes on in the sun. Anything there?
Big time. And 5 years ago, I would have scoffed at it. How can something on the sun affect earthquakes? There's no mechanism. Well, just look at the facts. Within 2 days of the World Series quake, there was a huge solar flare, an X-13.
Right.
And on the very day of the 6.2 Morgan Hill quake, there was an X-13. And on the day of the 7.4 at Eureka in 1980, there was an X-9.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw the list of the actual biggest solar flares and compared them with the known earthquake times, there was a huge correlation. So I have to say, it doesn't matter if I understand the mechanism. If I see the timing correlation, I'm going to say that it looks like there's a pattern. And I don't know what goes on when I turn on my television set. Just as long as I get a picture and a sound, I'm happy. So just as long as I see a correlation and I can make correlations into the future, make projections, and if I can be successful, then I accept that there's something going on.
All right. So if you don't mind, I'd kind of like to start into the phones and see what would like to ask you. Good. All right. The first time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Yes. I was wondering if Mr. Berkland is aware of the alignment of the planets that is supposed to happen on 5/5 this year on May the 5th.
Right.
I read a book by that title of May, you know, 5/5/2005, probably 7-8 years ago, and it was predicting because of the gravitational fields and the way that they affect the Earth that could be a massive events happening on May the 5th.
All right, well, let's look into that. Sure, people have been talking about that forever, and some people would say the other planets have so little gravitational effect that line up any way they want. It doesn't compare much to, for example, the effect of the moon. What do you say, Jim?
Al, you're so right. I would have, you know, kept an open mind on it, but when you have all the other planets, the tide-raising force varies with the cube of the distance, and it varies with the mass and the cube of the distance, and so these planets are out so far that really planets and stars have no effect on our crust. Now, if there's something magical, astrological, then it ought to work. I mean, if that worked, we would see it. I have yet to have an astrological prediction come true, but I've had a number of post-dictions. People say, oh, yeah, we could have predicted that because Uranus is twined Jupiter or something. But if you combine all of the gravitational forces from the rest of the planets, there'd be less than 1,000th the effect that the moon has. So unless we're looking for a trigger on a trigger, it's just not there. So I don't worry about that 555 thing at all.
With regard to your colleagues, somebody fast blasted me that it was jealousy. With regard to the way they treated you, Jim, now, do you think jealousy is at the core of it with regard to your making predictions, or do you think that something else, just sort of a piling on professional...
I would be happy if it were just jealousy. I know about 5 years ago, a lovely young gal was doing a television program on earthquakes and earthquake predictions. She said,
yes.
Jim, I'd like you to be on, and I'd like you to be on with people from Berkeley and Stanford and Hayward State and USGS. And I said, it's fine with me, but you may have a problem at the other end. She said, well, I don't think so. 3 days later, she called me and said, Jim, I've never seen such animosity in my life. They refused to be on the same time with you, the same show with you.
Well, I was about to say, is it a piling on of ridicule, just sort of piling on, or what's going on?
Well, back in... I mentioned I missed that first one in April of 1976, the first time I went public, and said, call me back in October. And as long as I missed, there was no problem. But then when I hit a doubleheader on the first day of my October window on the day of the eclipse, that's when heavy hitters came in.
Yeah, I can see that, of course. In other words, if you miss, you just sink to the back of the,
sure.
You know, and then out from sight altogether. But if you hit, then you become a target.
Very much so. And then in 1990, I was written up in the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, they went to USGS for comments, and one of the geologists said, we've known this fellow for his entire career, and he's been nothing but a clown. Now, I'm listed in who's who in America and who's who in science and technology and a bunch of other who's who's, and I'm a fellow in the Geological Society of America and a member of the Association of Engineering Geologists and Earthquake Engineering Research Institute and on and on and on. And so I'm not a clown at all. But that was a little too much. Well, I was still a county geologist, and they're demeaning me like that. So I went to Pete McCloskey, an attorney. And he wrote them a letter, and they got off my back. It cost me a bundle, but it was worth it.
Maybe you're nothing but a heartache for them.
I think so. And it's really unfortunate, because for the first 5 years, knowing that I'm not a seismologist nor a geophysicist, I went hat in hand to those professions in a box full of information and said, would you look at this? No, we don't have time for that, Jim. We have our own studies.
All right. Then if not jealousy, what? Put a word to it. What is it?
They are concerned about their own budgets. I'm a threat to their credibility. When they missed on the Parkfield earthquake.
Boy, they missed big on Parkfield.
And you know, when it actually occurred last September 26th was the day of the full moon. I thought that was most ironic. But it was about 6 years late. And they lost one-third of their geologists and almost lost their West Coast headquarters, which would have been a really crime. I really think the USGS is the finest scientific body in the world.
Why don't they think your body's so great?
I worked for them for 6 years.
Right.
And I really enjoyed it. Fantastic experience. And really had thought I would be able to work, you know, closely with them for my entire career. And that was true until they started predicting earthquakes. And even my best friend, I went to high school and to Berkeley with back in the late 70s, he said, Jim, come on, what are you doing here? Why don't you predict some big quakes? And I said, well, we're not having big quakes. You know, why don't I predict quakes for around the world? Well, I actually tried that in my newsletter for 50 tries. I took what I called a monthly outright seismic speculation. I just looked at a map or just looked for a hunch.
Yes.
I hit 4 out of 50. But the one that I hit was really almost spectacular. We took a trip to Egypt, toured up the Nile, and the day we arrived, I was in the shadow of the pyramids and saw a fellow reading Al-Aram. And I predicted in my newsletter we would have a 4.5 quake or better in Egypt while I was there, the 10 days I was there.
Yes.
And I mentioned, I'm looking to see if you have an earthquake. And his eyes widened up, and he pointed on the front page. They just had a 5.5 the day we arrived. So that was a hit, but it was, you know, pure luck.
So you're really best off when it comes to actual predictions, predicting for the area where you can gather the information, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Yes.
And you use the whole battery. You don't, anything that works, use it. You don't have to understand it even. Now, I've done, you know, scuba diving in Hawaii and Virgin Islands. And when you see the fish down there and they suddenly change direction.
Yes.
100, 200 fish change instantly and they don't bump into each other. Same thing with a flock of birds.
Yes.
How do they do that? It has to be electrical. Now, when I had a bobcat as a pet, and I was with the U.S. Geological Survey, he used to go in traffic and drive down there with me. And when I'd leave him home, my mother would always say, Jim's coming home. Put on the coffee or reheat the dinner. He's coming home. At irregular hours, irregular days, she would know he's coming home because the bobcat would get up and wait by the front door. And I debunked it. I just didn't want to. My mom, what does she know? She's not a scientist. It can't be.
Oh, it's been well proven.
Now it's well established.
Yes.
In fact, I met the author of Pets Who Know When Their Owners, Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home.
That's right.
And he was at a meeting here in the little town of Sonoma, a book signing about 5 years ago. And I was sitting back in the audience of about 30, 40 people. And a question arose after he finished talking. They said, well, what about this story about animals being able to predict earthquakes? And he said, well, the one person that I know that's most advanced in that is Jim Berkland.
Right.
And I raised my hand and said, how do you do?
Parkfield. Go back to Parkfield for
yes.
a moment. They really stuck their neck out on that.
Yes.
Now, what can you tell me? I would love to know what information they based that prediction on. And I'd also love to know a little of the politics that went into making the decision to publicly make that prediction.
Oh, well, that was a huge political decision, yes.
I bet.
It happened in 1966. There were a pair of 5.5 magnitude quakes at Parkfield, and I was in Coalinga and got jostled by both of them. In fact, I was writing a letter to my wife-to-be at the time.
Yes.
Drove me out of the motel, and we all exchanged, you know, well, that was quite a shake, and then we went back inside, and another 20 minutes, we're outside again.
But this particular prediction, Jim, how did they make that?
Well, they knew that in 1966 it had happened, in 1934 it had happened, in 1922 it had happened, 1901, all the way back to 1857. So about every 22 years, they were getting a 5.5 to 6.5 magnitude quake there.
So this was historical information?
22 years. But they had to ignore the fact that in 1922 to 34 was only 12 years.
Huh.
But then from 34 till 66, if you added the 12 years and the 30 years, you get to 44 divided by 2, you get 22 years.
So you're telling me they made this just on historical information?
Yes. They said, well, if the fault is increasing strain at a given rate, it should slip every so often. And sure enough, it seemed to do that here. So they put instruments from all kinds and drilled holes and brought in the international crews there waiting to catch that earthquake.
Did they see changes in their instrumentation that indicated it was on the way?
A few false alarms. And while I was back east on the Bill Cosby show, they flipped the paper underneath my hotel and it said that the quake had happened. They actually had a 4.5.
Right.
And that was not big enough. But they thought maybe that's a foreshock. And so there was, you know, great interest in the 6-magnitude quake finally coming. But now I understand, with all the instrumentation that's still there, there were almost no clues that anything was up last September except what was up was the full moon.
What was the politics like behind the Parkfield prediction?
Well, they had to justify a budget. They'd known that the Chinese had predicted a quake in 1975.
So
evacuated the city of Haicheng.
Was a prediction gap?
Yes. Yes. And so, and then here's another one. This one really frosts me. They tried to do what the Chinese did with a program called Earthquake Watch.
Yes.
And I was a member for 3 years, a four-year program. And if your pet or wild animal or farm animal did something really weird, you'd assign it a 3 or a 4, and you would call in immediately on the hotline given to you. If it's just a 0, 1, or 2, you'd just sort of fill it in and turn in the monthly report. Well, on September 7th, 1980, I saw three things that really made me react. One, we had the most missing cats of the entire year, only 14 ads, but that was still most of the year. We had the new moon, and the previous new moon had resulted in 25,000 deaths in Algeria, and the previous full moon had resulted in 300 deaths in southern Mexico. So we're up to the next syzygy, the new moon on the 7th. And then the third factor, I called Olga Kolbeck over at the geyser, Calistoga Geyser, the only geyser in California.
Yes.
And I'd known that the geyser was slowing down its eruption cycle prior to Northern California quakes. So on that noontime, I called her from my office and said, Olga, these things are happening with the cats and the tides. What's happening with your geyser? Jim, we're about to phone you. This morning it didn't erupt for 3 hours and 12 minutes instead of the normal 40 minutes. That was the all-time record and still stands. And I said, oh, looks like a big one in Northern California. I'm going to call USGS and predict it. She says, if you don't, I'm going to.
Oh.
So I immediately called the hotline. I said, based on these three separate factors, I'm calling for a 6.5 or better in Northern California within a week. Time, place, magnitude. We hadn't had a 6.5 for 14 years.
When you call USGS, who do you talk to?
Well, this was an automatic tape line.
Ah, so you left a message.
Tape recorded. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. And so at the end of the year, in the previous 2 years, I'd gotten a transcript of my hotline calls. In 1981, I didn't get my 1980 calls. Along about July, I said, did you send those out? Oh, you should have had them long ago. So I'll look into it. Nothing happened. So in August, I called again. Oh, yeah, I meant to check on that. Then I got 9 of my 10 calls, and the 9 calls were just saying the dogs howled all night, or some fellas told us their cat were doing strange things. I didn't make any predictions except that one time. Let them draw their own conclusions.
Do you still call USGS?
But you know what happened?
What?
They said they lost that tape.
They lost the tape?
It was mailed all the way from Menlo Park to Palo Alto, you know, which have, you can spit across the boundary.
Well, maybe they had to send it to Rosemary Woods.
They said, we have a tracer on it. Sure, a year later, they still had a tracer on it. They thought they destroyed the evidence. But I had a letter written by my assistant who was on the extension phone, and he knows what went on.
All right. Birkeland and the USGS. Who is he? Nothing but a heartache. Good morning, everybody. I'm Art Bell.
Yeah. talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and this night, Jim Berkland, lots of activity going on around the world right now, volcanic, tectonic, lots of shaking, and kind of a feeling of foreboding. Good time to have Berkland on. The following may be way outside Jim Berkland's field, or maybe there's a little bit of scissor D here. I refer, of course, to the Princeton experiments going on right now with regard to consciousness. Now, as we know, they have these eggs planted around the world. I referred to them early on in the show. These eggs are nothing more than computers that are spitting out random numbers, and that's what they ought to be, random. But all of a sudden, before large events on Earth, like 9/11, like the Sumatra disaster, and we could go on and on and on back through history as long as this experiment has been going on at Princeton, these graphs have started to just climb right off the chart prior to these events happening. Now, Jim, I wonder if you've heard of this at all, number one, and number two, whether you think it might have some relationship to what you're talking about with animals and with all these other somewhat esoteric things that point toward a big event like an earthquake.
Yes, there are so many unknowns. Now, I did hear that engineer back at Princeton talk about random generators and how they could affect them.
Yes.
Just with thought.
Yes.
And I've heard about your experiments on changing hurricanes and diverting them and things.
Yes.
So how could nobody? We can't rule things out. I've had earthquake dreams that I can't explain, except they happened. I've had contact with a number of psychic people, and I know some are legitimate. There's just no question. So this is most intriguing. Now, you know about Charlotte King?
Yes.
Okay. On my site, she just put something about meteoric fireballs before the major eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. Well, they just had fireballs again up in the northwest.
That's correct.
And they're called meteoric fireballs, and they're usually blue, green, or orange.
All right. Listen, that's another little piece of scissorgy that may be real. Let's go back to the phone. So many people waiting to talk to you. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hi, John.
Hi.
First, Art, sorry to say, I'd like to say that I'd like the old days, back in the days when you were doing it on a more regular basis, because feeling is a little different.
Well, but I appreciate my weekend.
Another comment, and regarding that is,
yes.
I especially like how you maintain the professionalism, especially with guests, that you're not quite sure about, for whatever reason.
Okay.
I'm going to say that about tonight's guest. Jim, at least not until I hear what you have to say about the two things I'd like you to comment on.
Which are?
The first one is I'd like him to explain further about the idea that the core of the Earth is liquid, not a furnace, that magma is created by the friction between plates.
Okay.
And secondly, sorry, I'm going to listen off air. I've been waiting a while. And secondly, the fact, or my understanding is that sonic booms cause approximately 2.7 magnitude readings on seismometers. Can you explain how that...
Okay. All right. We'll attack both of them. Thank you. The core of the Earth first, I guess.
Okay. Well, they discovered in the 1930s through seismic waves that there is a solid inner core.
Iron, isn't it? Thought
nickel
to be.
Iron, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it allows the P wave to speed up a little bit, going through the middle of the liquid core because there's a solid core inside. Meanwhile, the S wave can't make it there at all because it can't go through a liquid. So they're in that solid core reacting to the liquid core and mantle. Apparently, they're spinning at different directions, and that's where we get our magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't have a liquid core at all, I guess there wouldn't be a magnetic field. Let's see.
Then the sonic boom's registering 2.7.
Yes. Now, a P wave is really a sound wave traveling through the Earth. And it's a push-pull like a slinky. You have it in one hand and give it a jolt, and you can see the wave passing longitudinally through the slinky. And it's the compression rarefaction. So when the sound wave hits the ground, it's like an explosion, really. And so P waves mostly form underground and come out to the Earth's surface, and then you can hear them in the deep, low-frequency rumble.
Right.
But it works the other way, too. And I understand that when they had these experimental planes, there'd be a lot of airquakes that the military wouldn't want to admit to.
Does that, in fact, register at about a 2.7, typically, or is?
Well, it would take a pretty big one. The 2.7 is fairly strong. But what was interesting is that once it hits the ground, it travels faster in the ground than it does in the air. So if it happens off at Santa Monica, they can then...
Why is that, Jim? Why does it... I know it travels faster through the ground, through rock, than it does through the air. That seems illogical.
Not really, because it's the spacing of the molecules.
Oh.
They're close together. They just like a bunch of pennies in a line. You hit one, remember, and knocked one off the end?
Gotcha.
Okay, that's all the difference. If you... used to notice that swimming in the creek would click a couple rocks together, and you could hear it underwater faster than you would hear it in the air.
I don't know that I ever made that measurement personally, but okay.
Just stumbled onto it.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Yes, I have four quick questions for you and your guests.
Four might be too many.
I'll cut it down to three. The first question has to do with the Earth's... magnetic field reversing. I saw a documentary that says every 300,000 years or
more,
it flips over from north to south and back to south. And the North Pole goes down, the positive goes to the south. And
so your question is that true or what?
Yeah, my question is, would this have any effect on the plates, the electromagnetic phenomena,
hold it right there. Would the tectonic plates go nuts if we had a reversal?
No.
The electromagnetic field of the Earth itself.
Well, it goes through a null point. When you shift, when the magnetic needle north-seeking suddenly becomes south-seeking, it takes several thousand years for this transition to occur based on studies that we did in the volcanic rocks.
There are others, though, have said they occur quite quickly, relatively quickly.
Well, show me an example. I mean, we have the rock example, and there are very few zones that show transitions. But where they do, at the ages show, it takes several thousand years, like three or four.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, when it goes through a null point, we have no protective ionosphere.
Right.
That means all the cosmic radiation comes booming through, and there's bound to be a lot of genetic changes.
Okay. Second question?
My second question has to do with that. I watched a documentary by the U.S. Geological Survey, and they said that the Mississippi River and the reason why Louisiana is below sea level was the fact that there was a magnitude 0.12 or 15 earthquake that shifted that part of the United States.
Oh, gosh, that wouldn't have been from the USGS.
Okay. Well,
there was a magnitude 8, three of them. In 1811, 1812, it caused the Mississippi to reverse, but Louisiana is not below sea level.
Let's get something straight right here. You read in a lot of science fiction about magnitude 11, 12, 13, 14. Are these things possible or not? Is 10 the biggest earthquake that could happen?
There's no theoretical limit except the strength of the rocks. The rocks have to store up strain.
Oh.
And the rocks are going to yield before they reach 11 or 12. But when the big meteor at Chicxulub hit down in Guatemala, Honduras, it was equivalent to about a 15, magnitude 15.
Wow.
But that was extraterrestrial, and the Earth can't store up that much strain to yield that kind of a magnitude.
All right, so then it's generally thought that anything that would be produced on the Earth or within the Earth would be within that 10 limit.
Yeah, less than 10. In fact, Richter scale, they never had a 9 Richter, which the 8.9 were a couple of them. Now they've upgraded them to 9.2 to 9.5.
Right. Okay, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Hello, this is Dan from California.
Hello, Dan.
I'm glad to speak to you guys this morning, Jim and Art, or Art and Jim.
Yes.
My question, one thing is I'd like to be sympathetic to Jim and tell him that his job has to be like looking outside of a soundproof window, and you're trying to yell at the person that there's a tidal wave coming, and they're only looking at your gestures of jumping up and down and not hearing what you're trying to say. And I hope that you do be able to sleep at night because you can't save the world. And the reason why I think that it's such a problem for you is that it's life versus economics. If you try to get to a large TV station and tell people what's going to happen, what would we do? And here's a question within itself. What would you do if you could get on Channel 10 at 5 o'clock and warn everyone?
Yeah.
Are we saying evacuate a whole city? What's the cost of that? Where are we going to put them? Or are you telling them to prepare? And
it
isn't it awful like knowing that that's like somebody from across the field shooting a bullet, and in 3 to 4 days it may hit you? Is it more like that? That's why they don't want us to know?
Just view me as a meteorologist, recognizing a low-pressure cell developing out in the Atlantic, saying, watch it. Let's see what other clues are coming. You can make your own decisions if you're going to board up your windows or not and evacuate. But you're not going to evacuate for an earthquake. That just is not practical. There's too many problems that would develop. Traffic couldn't move. I urge people to check the seismic windows when the maximum tides are occurring and then watch for the local effects. If you have, in San Jose, for example, here was this formerly artesian well that hadn't been artesian for 25 years. It suddenly began to flow so rapidly, it was flooding out the neighborhood. And so the city fathers came out and put a stop on the top, and it blew the cork. So they put a stronger cap on it, and they walked away and figured their job was done. It was April 17, 1906, the day before the big one hit San Francisco.
Wow.
So there are these kinds of clues that develop, and if people just turn their back on them, they're never going to recognize them. And so I'm just keep. And by the way, I have no problem whatsoever sleeping. I'm very happy with what I'm doing and very comfortable with myself. I went to the Great Pyramid. And when I came out of the Great Pyramid, I suddenly realized what it's all about. Why are we here? We are here to seek our purpose and strive to achieve it. Anything less is a waste of existence. And that just took a whole load off me. I said, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, it's important that you be comfortable with what you're doing because it's very controversial, and without that comfort, there'd be a lot of rough moments. No question about it, Jim.
Well, let me tell you, I just got somebody named Woody in Astoria says, brief little message on my website, has Jim just lent credibility to Art Bell? You've got the problem, too.
All right, Jim. You're on the air with Jim Berkland. Good morning.
Hi, guys. Okay, I'm calling from Toronto, Canada.
Yes, sir.
And my question is, I believe it must have been your guest I saw on a television special. It was, I believe, studying a volcano, actually in a volcano in somewhere in Italy. Anyway, there were some seismologists and volcanologists who were commenting that studying a volcano using satellites and other remote electronics equipment is good enough, but to actually climb in a volcano and study it is really just foolish and just being a bare-chested, silly, macho type person. So I'm wondering specifically how much importance do you suggest in studying volcanoes actually in a volcano rather than just using remote electronics? Actually, smelling the smoke, hearing the faint rumblings, timing them apart in person. How important is
How important is it to go down into a volcano to study it, Jim?
Not very important for me. I've never done that and wouldn't plan to do it. We have plenty of robots that will handle that now and can fly over. The only volcanic flows I've seen were, you know, as they were entering the ocean and pouring over in little solid waterfalls.
So you don't possible. You don't want to find a tube to crawl into at St. Helens?
No, thank you.
Okay, so I guess the answer is instruments will do, sir. First time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I got two questions. I guess one might be a little outside of Jim's realm, but the first is, does he have any, like, I guess stats, for lack of a better term? I mean, just to add, I believe what he's saying, but to lend credibility, like, so
right.
You've predicted 180 of hit.
All right. Exactly what is your hit and miss rate, Jim?
Well, I haven't even bothered. It's around 70 to 75% in the last 30 years. I haven't counted them all up lately. There were, you know, literally a couple of thousand predictions, and I've hit about 70%.
There you are. 70%, sir. How's that?
But look at my, come to my website. Visit my website and subscribe to my newsletter, and you'll get the exact details. I gave some figures on the Puget Sound quakes. Oh, by the way, Art.
No, wait. So anyway, that's an important question. This is an important question for your own credibility, and you're saying it's right around 70%, right?
Yes.
That's a big item. Does that answer your question, caller?
Yeah, it does. I have one other question, too, and it might be a little... But when you were talking about could you drill into a volcano and pressure out,
oh, yeah.
I had the same sort of theory with hurricanes, and I don't know if this is clean out of his realm, but the whole concept of a hurricane is that it's a condensed eye. And couldn't you just blow that eye up, suck the oxygen out of that eye, and collapse the hurricane on itself?
It is out of your field, Jim.
But it's a low pressure. The lowest pressures they get is around, you know, 26 inches in the middle of the eye of a hurricane. But I think maybe they're already doing that with HARP and chemtrails and Lord knows what else. I think there's a lot of weather experimentation going on that we don't even know about.
Yes, no doubt. A lot of weather experimentation, I'm sure, is ongoing. How are you just going to continue at about the same rate making predictions the way you have been in the newsletter, or do you have plans that go beyond that now, or what?
Well, you know, I've had a number of people that are going to write my life story, or they're going to set up a new program, and they all seem to drop out once they talk to high science. High science just doesn't have any time for me, and we'll see what happens after the book is released here in December.
Well, high science isn't doing so very well themselves in the prediction category.
They made 12 predictions that I knew about, and none have hit. And so I think it was pretty frustrating for them. And obviously, I have hit so many to a television crew. I was on the front line, made predictions for a local quake and a major quake around the world, and hit both of them. On the camera, and those were carried, and we shall see now. Oh, by the way, I want to try again. If people want to send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, but I want them to put a couple of dollars in there to make it worth more while.
I see.
And I will send them a sample copy of my newsletter.
All right. Well, where do you send a couple bucks?
Easy enough. Jim Berkland. Spell it any way you want. P.O. Box 1926 in the little town of Glen Ellen, two words, G-L-E-N-E-L-L-E-N, California, and the zip code is 95442. A business-sized, self-addressed, stamped envelope with a couple dollars in it, and I'll be happy to send them a sample copy of my newsletter.
All right. Well, that's certainly fair enough. And also, there are going to be many people who just heard that and said, damn it, I didn't have a pencil or something. So I'll tell you what, folks, we'll take a break right here. And when we come back, we'll repeat that information for you. So that will give you an opportunity to go and get a pen, pencil, and paper, because I know you didn't have it ready. Now you will have no excuse. Get that pencil, get that paper right now.
You know.
hookah, hookah,
deep inside of me.
Hookah, hookah,
girl, you just don't realize what you do to me.
Hookah, 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 chaka, hookah.
When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's alright. That's candy. It's tasted on my mind. Girl, you got me thirsty for another cup of wine. Got a bug from you, girl, but I don't need a cure. I just stay a victim if I can for sure.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Rocking through the night this night with Jim Berkland. He predicts earthquakes, much to the dismay of the USGS and some others, but he does it rather successfully at about, what, 70%? That's pretty good in my book. All right, as promised, hopefully you've gathered together writing implements and such, and to get a free copy, well, not free, it's a couple bucks, you know, for shipping and licking and whatever, a couple of bucks for Jim's newsletter, and you can decide for yourself. And we promised you that address, so you could now write it down, that you're armed and ready. Go ahead, Jim.
It's P.O. Box 1926. That was 4 years before I was born, 1926. Glen Ellen, G-L-E-N-E-L-L-E-N, California, and the zip is 95442.
And you personally put them all in the envelope and licked those envelopes shut.
Yes, I'm the one. It took me about 3 months that last time.
Uh-huh.
But, that was for free. When I asked for a couple of bucks, the numbers go way down.
I can imagine there would be a difference, all right.
Uh-huh.
People love that word free.
Oh, my, yes.
however, if you have a really good record of predicting earthquakes, then people will pay attention, so I'm sure there'll be some dollars on the way.
Yeah, go right to the website. We summarize the predictions each month on the website, but there's a lot more information that goes into the eight-page newsletter.
Okay, here we go. Let's go here. You're on the air with Jim Berkland. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was calling to ask if Mr. Berkland had mentioned he had a business phone number that he was going to give out to make information available to him. And the other was about the Puget Sound area that he was about to give you information on.
Okay, one at a time. Phone. Do
certainly.
You want to give out some phone number?
Well,
Jim?
I just have my own personal phone. But go to my
you want to give that
website.
Out? You want to give out your personal phone number? I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, it's on my website. If you go to the trouble getting the website, you'll see it there.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's amazing. All right, and then the Puget Sound area, right, ma'am?
That's right. He was very excited to tell you something about it when you were discussing his correct hits, right?
Go right ahead.
Well, they just had one at Olympia of 3.3 today, and I'd predicted a 3 or better in Washington or Oregon, so that's a 100% hit. And I just had compiled the list of all of the quakes in that area since the year 2000, And there were 22 quakes that exceeded a 3.0, and 18 of the 22 were in a window, as was this one. So the numbers are very favorable to maximum tidal periods.
It may well be that there is nothing in this category right now, but it always bears asking, Jim, do you see any, you know, people obviously are concerned about the bigger earthquakes.
Oh, yeah.
I fully understand that for your, you, to establish credibility for what you do, you have to get them big and small, but are there any big ones coming?
Well, everyone's concerned about the Northwest and that Cascadia Trench where the 9-plus magnitude quake hit. On January 26th of 1700, interesting how they came up with that. They knew the Indian legends about the big wave that came in and the villages that were destroyed. Well, geologists have mapped ups and downs of the seacoast there and forests that were buried and salt waves had come in and killed, kind of poisoned the soils.
Yes.
But then in Japan, where they had written records for that time of 1700, there was this mysterious tsunami that came in and killed several hundred Japanese.
Yes.
And so they had the records, and we had the other kind of records. Approximately, you know, 300 years ago, we knew that that was true. And so their date, they gave it 3 days to travel across the Pacific. And so whenever the tsunami hit them, they subtracted 3 days, and it ends up as June 26th. And I've looked at the old tides there, and that was at a time in between two huge tides. It was in a semi-quiet period between two maximum tides, Peridian spring tides.
Okay. My question was, do you see any big earthquakes coming?
Yes. But just when? See, we have to, if you suddenly get mass beachings of whales and dolphins.
Okay, but so apparently you don't see anything immediate that you want to...
Oh, that's true. I would tell you if I had something in particular. Now, I'm troubled, like you are, about all of these animal reports, and we heard about the thing about solar flares have picked up during this period when they're not supposed to be happening. We've had some northern lights, and we had this fireball. And going back through a lot of records, there were surprising how many times there's a mention of a fireball prior to a big quake.
All right, first-time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Good morning.
Good morning, guy. Actually, good evening and aloha from Paradise here in Hilo.
Oh,
all right.
Yes.
Yes, I live in the shadows. This is Rich calling from Hilo, by the way. And I am living in the shadows, basically the largest volcanic range on Earth.
Yep.
At least that's what they tell us here.
Mm-hmm.
Mauna Kea is just about 20 miles away from the harbor here. And I moved here about a year ago from San Luis Obispo, where I had just had experienced my first 6.5 in December 03, Jim, if you can recall that.
Sure, 22nd.
It was a pretty good shake. I was living right on the beach there. And I haven't felt even nothing here in the Hilo area. However, there are an awful lot of USGS vans and trucks and quite a few personnel that come down in the Hilo area that I just assume they're over in the Volcano National Park up in Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa. My question being, I haven't felt anything in almost a year here, and I'm wondering what's your take on the predictions and the possibilities of something here on the Big Island.
Well, I'm really surprised you haven't felt one of the fours they've had there in the last few weeks. You know, Hawaii, the Big Island is the shakiest island in Hawaii, and of all of the states, if you take the area involved, Hawaii is the number one shaky state, more than California or Alaska, because of its area. The chances of feeling a quake in Hawaii are much greater than any place in California or Alaska, but, you know, just in general. But, yes, as to a really big one, they're mostly concerned about what might happen over on the Eastern Rift Zone. A big landslide, a submarine landslide, might cause a local tsunami. And of course, we're going to be over there in June, so maybe you can set up something for us.
All right. All right, well, I think I once asked you, and it was kind of an interesting answer, as I recall. If you could be at the site of a very large earthquake, would you do it? Would you go there?
Yes, but I wouldn't be on top of the county building as I was for the Loma Prieta quake.
Uh-huh.
That's the only quake of the 80-plus that I have felt, the only one that ever frightened me. I didn't think the building was going to withstand it. It was moving back and forth about 5 feet. And my office was a shambles, all my rocks and books that toppled over on the facing east and the open. I couldn't see the floor, shelves dropping. It was quite an experience. And
well, I lived 10 years of my life on the island of Okinawa, Jim, and I went through a lot of really big earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have no desire whatsoever to experience another one, and I have experienced several. We had a pretty good one here in the desert, as you know, a number of years ago.
Real yes, you called me right after
snorter.
It.
Oh, man. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
Pleasure speaking to you and Jim.
Hey.
I've enjoyed and learned a lot from the both of you over the years here. A comment and a quick question. I have... you're a cat man. I'm a ferret man. I have several ferrets, and it was interesting. About a week ago, they began behaving very, very strangely.
Ferret and, misbehavior.
Well, I don't know if it was misbehavior. All I know is I didn't feel it, but my brother did in Boston. I guess there was a quake up in Quebec.
Oh, yes, 5.1 or 5.2 or so. Yeah.
I'm 60 miles south of Lake Erie, so I don't know, you know, about...
You could have felt that easily, yes.
You know, that was the one thing. And then the other thing is, I heard your other fireworks buddy call, Art. I'm a pyrotechnician, and basically we did built a 36-inch diameter shell and fired it at a big competition up here in our area. And the gas company actually brought a seismologist in because about 2 miles away, I guess they had an underground line running.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually worried that this thing coming out of the mortar would affect 2 miles away their gas line. Yeah. Would the waves, would there be that easily, Jim, the transmission of... the force of, you know, it was about a 970-pound shell that we popped about 2,000 feet in the air.
Would that show up seismically, Jim?
Yes, that would vibrate the ground for sure, and I can understand why they might be a little concerned, especially if their gas line was in weak materials. It might have a little liquefaction and, you know, fissures. It doesn't hurt to instrument when you're having a blast like that.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Jim. I wanted to salute your credibility rather than take any away from it.
Okay.
And I'll give a cross-disciplinary example. You and I go back about the same time in birth, and this is Rich from Lawrence, Kansas.
Uh-huh.
But back when the earth was cooling, I worked as a grad student and actually lived there as part of my pay at Northwestern University Dearborn Observatory.
No, I thought you were saying you were here when the earth was cooling.
I was wondering.
No.
All right.
Well, I just think that I was born back when the earth was cooling.
I see.
Yeah. But anyway, this was before J. Allen Hynek was even there. And Emanuel Velikovsky's book came out, Worlds in Collision.
Yep.
And the chairman at the time not only panned it, but that's all they could talk about. They, you know, we thought the gentleman spoke too much. And then they wrote letters to the publisher, and who I think was one of Bennett Cerf's subsidiaries, and forced them to stop publishing it because with the threat that they wouldn't adopt textbooks. And so, you know, Velikovsky later turned out to be right.
And of
course, another publisher did take it up. I think it was Holt or somebody like that. But also, I wanted to, also, your credibility again. My dad barely missed being killed in the great Galveston tidal wave.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the story about why he wasn't, except I wouldn't be here otherwise. And the estimate then was 30,000 killed in one day. It's in the newspapers. We have photos of the newspapers and all. And yet now, you go and read about it more and more by the more recent experts, and they've got it down to 6,000. And, yep. And I just wondered if you ever studied that phenomenon at all. But
well, we were talking about that, the sort of the rewriting of history of calamities and mass deaths and the numbers involved and how they shift and change so strangely, right, Jim?
Yes, and there was another big hurricane in the Keys where they had some kind of unemployed people were put to work down there, and they didn't really take care of them, and there were many, many killed in a big hurricane there that they knew was coming but didn't pay that much attention to it.
Oh, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland.
Hi, Art. This is Jacob from Preston. Hi, Jim.
Hey,
I have a quick question. Has anyone thought about the possibility of earthquakes on the moon or Mars?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know it sounds far-fetched, but you have to believe.
No, not at all.
If there's earthquakes on planet Earth.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was one of the first things that turned me around back in 1975.
Yeah. And if NASA plans to build and President Bush wants to go to Mars and the moon, they better start listening to guys like you, because we're going to invest a lot of money on there. And
well, the thing is, the strongest quake they ever measured on the moon was about a 4.8. Most of them are just ones and twos.
Hmm.
But the thing is, they almost all occur once a month when the Earth and moon are closest to perigee. And there's, as they say, there's no serious alternative to a tidal explanation. And
do we know enough about the interior of the moon, Jim, to understand the dynamics of what's going on under there?
It doesn't have a magnetic field today. It used to have.
Right.
And so it almost certainly doesn't have a liquid core, and it doesn't have active volcanoes.
Right.
It doesn't have moving plates.
So what the heck's earthquaking?
It's the stress from the Earth, from the gravity from the Earth at perigee.
Which is moving.
It's actually deforming the moon. You know, it's moving up and down. In fact, the solid Earth goes up and down about 3 feet under the full moon. And that's enough. That's why the gravity is also effective away from the ocean tides, because there's an Earth tide.
You're saying the Earth bulges out three feet.
The moon pulls it up, deforms it.
I never noticed that.
Yeah. And I didn't know it either when I first got into earthquake predictions. I just sort of surmised that since the ocean water was going up and down, probably the solid Earth was going up and down too, and that could trigger quakes, and that's what got me into this.
And they have confirmed this how?
Oh, yeah.
They what, can satellites or what?
With gravimeters. The gravity of the Earth decreases when you get further away from the core, from the center of the Earth, and they can actually see the within 2 hours of the full moon, the Earth bulges up, and ocean
tides.
That's
eerie to even think about. That's really weird.
Yeah, well, you know, but Io, the closest satellite to Jupiter.
Yes.
It goes up and down about 300 feet every Io day, and all that fluxion it generates magma. They have, you know, sulfur volcanoes on them. The satellite
aisle. Friction is heat.
Yeah.
Right? Very quickly, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Yeah, hi there, and good morning to you, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call, Art.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Jim about when they dig into... Actually, I'm really sensitive to Earth's movements. I've had multiple injuries, and that's one of the reasons. Plus, I've lived on the West Coast, and I've felt earthquakes, and I've been over in Europe, and I know the feeling in the big cities with the underground and what like the trains and that are underground, and when they tunnel underground like that and they're putting an underground tunnel, does that have any effect elsewhere on the Earth? Like if there's tunneling going on, would that be
not miles away?
Not miles away.
In the county building, we're on the seventh floor, and all the women especially began to complain they were feeling earthquakes. Well, it turns out they were building the electric rail and the jackhammers out in the street.
Really?
Were vibrating up the columns of the building a few, you know, 50 yards away and vibrating the building. And so after they finished the jackhammers, the little microquakes ended.
So, and there are people, though, that are also sensitive in the way she described, aren't
right.
there?
Right, no doubt.
Is there one single place where these people report their feelings, Jim?
Well, right on my site. We have it for sensitives. We have it for dreamers. We have it. For, just go to my site, syzygyjobe.com.
Not anything, really.
Yeah, dot anything. So I've placed for phenomena, earthquake sensitives, seismic sentries with the pets and animals. Frank Condon is a scientist that measures electric fields in Southern California, and he has a site here. And we have places just to ask questions of me, earthquake sensitives, phenomena.
All right. Well, we've got a link on our site right now, and I'm sure a number of people are going to make it there. Jim, we're out of time. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. It
Great.
Always is.
I really enjoyed it.
And seismically yours. Take care, buddy.
Thank you. You too.
Good night. And here she is. All the right words to get us out of here. It's been a great weekend. Thank you. See you next weekend. Until then, from the high desert, good night.
Good night in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. Belonging, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?